Okay. Good morning and welcome to the February 22nd, 2011 San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. We have a strategic planning session today. Before we begin that, please rise and join us for the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God,
okay. Madam Clerk, could you let us know of any changes to the agenda, please?
We have an added item with closed session, pending litigation, a conference with legal counsel regarding Brock Charlotte versus Heritage Ranch Owners Association et al., conference with legal counsel, exposure to litigation, number of cases 2, item 2, personnel, consider public employee appointment for the position of Ag Commissioner, Sealer of Weights and Measures. All requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied, as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement.
Okay, thank you, Madam Clerk. Before we go to public comment, just want to point out that we are missing our first district supervisor, Mr. Meacham, who is recovering from some minor back surgery, and we wish him well, and he's watching at home, I know, and we look forward to his return. I guess I'll tell you how he heard it. He was watching the Grammys, and just like many a American teenager, he was outraged when Justin Bieber did not win New Artist of the Year. And Mr. Meacham lunged from his chair in anger and hurt his back, and now he's recovering. But no, just kidding. All right. I've just confused him at home, I know.
Mr. Chairman, among other things, we may well see him on the dais to rebut that.
That'll get him back. All right, let us please move. I'm getting all the slips here, so let us move into public comment. Wow, they're all coming in fast and furious. Let me start with Mr. Alsop in public comment, who wants to give us a little bit of information on the disaster loan assistance. If you could, Ron, I would appreciate that.
Thank you. Good morning. Ron Alsop, County Office of Emergency Services. And I just wanted to provide an update and a reminder that for the victims of the recent flooding, the storms in mid-December into early January, that low-interest loan disaster assistance is available. There is an office opened by the Small Business Administration in Grover Beach. Initially, they weren't having too much business, unfortunately. However, I understand that has picked up. But we did want to remind people that there is low-interest loan assistance available both for renters, homeowners, as well as business owners. And a reminder that in the case of disasters, the name of the agency, the Small Business Administration, is somewhat of a misnomer, and that they, again, do provide low-interest loans to renters and others affected by disaster, as well as homeowners. So we wanted to encourage people to apply. In addition to the Disaster Center at Ramona Garden Park Center on Ramona Avenue in Grover Beach, there's also an 800 number for the SBA. It's 800. Time out here. Who knows what kind of 800 number I give you without my reading glasses. 800-659-2955. Again, 800-659-2955. And we know we had a lot of people affected by the flooding. We encourage people to apply for that, the low-interest loan disaster assistance. And also wanted to take the opportunity to bleed into, in New Zealand, as we saw a very damaging earthquake, modern cities such as we have here. And just a reminder, not only are we susceptible to flooding and other emergencies, but as we well know, and as Supervisor Meacham constantly reminds us, we need to be prepared for earthquakes in our own area as well as flooding and other disasters. So it is something to take seriously. And I know all five of you board members support that, but I know in particular, Supervisor Meacham was always reminding people that we really do need to be prepared. It's a serious event, and something could happen any time, earthquake, flooding, or any other type of disaster. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ron. I appreciate it. So let's move into general public comment, beginning with Richard Margetson, followed by Mike Wynn.
Good Richard Margetson. Again, I notice I have two items today to talk about. I noticed that the deputy sheriff is in the back of the room for public comment. The sheriff I saw was out in the hall. He still may be there, and I think the undersheriff is in the room. I think Los Osos, and I think your constituents need an explanation of why the sheriff is here only for public comment. I'm going to keep asking this, and if we have to ramp up the number of people that come and ask this question, we will do it. And if you don't think that we can fill this room, test us. I know there's an election next year, and you don't want to make a mistake, but this community, especially Los Osos, deserves an answer to why the sheriff is here just for public comment and then leaves after public comment's over. If Los Osos or somebody from Los Osos was going to attempt to do something in these chambers, do you think they're stupid enough to do it while he's here? If he's going to be here for public comment, then he should be here for the entire meeting. The entire meeting. We're going to keep asking this till we get an answer. My second comment is $8 million has been spent on the Los Osos wastewater project at this point. Has anybody read the staff report to the State Water Resources Control Board for the meeting on next Tuesday asking for the funding for the SRF? It's riddled with factual errors. Not my opinion of factual errors that don't even match other reports that you put out recently. Just wanted to bring that to your attention because it will be coming up in the near future. Thank you.
Mike Wynn, followed by Al Barrow.
Good morning, Chairman Hill, Supervisors. My name is Mike Wynn. I'm from Napomo. I just want very briefly to urge you to consider increasing the funding and the staffing for code enforcement. I know that sounds counterintuitive because it's difficult times right now with the budget. You have less money than you need or should have. But the reality is that code enforcement is countercyclical. When things are going very well and there's lots of building, most people do go out and get building permits and do the things that they're required to do. At the moment, with very little new construction going on, a lot of people are doing remodels, additions, other such things. Much of it is not permitted. It's not being permitted. It's not being inspected by your people. In addition to which, there's all sorts of home auto repair with the petroleum and antifreeze and other things being dumped into the gutters. In short, we have a very serious problem at the moment. And this is not a great time to tell you this, but nonetheless, it's really needed. Think, if you will, of code enforcement being countercyclical and needing something that perhaps some of your other departments can wait for. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn.
By the way, that was unsolicited by the code enforcement people.
Okay.
Not paid for.
Not paid for. Okay, thank you. I just wanted to note before we go to Mr. Barrow, followed by Gwen Taylor, that our overhead projector is not working, so sorry about that. Mr. Barrow, followed by Gwen Taylor.
Good afternoon, board, public. Loving kindness to all creatures. The spirit of my remarks are within that boundary of loving kindness. However, they are critical. The first thing I wanted to say to you was that the water rates, my machine isn't working either, so this is sad, but anyway, the water rates that the State Water Resources Control Board revealed in their study of 2004 said that the county water rates, the wastewater rates were $20 a month on average. The California state water rates were $20 a month on average. The application for the State Water Resource Control Board loan showed that it was about $240 a month for Los Osos. Is that remarkable for anybody? Everybody in the county basically is paying $20 a month, and you're asking a burden of almost $250 a month, or 12 times for Los Osos. That is a shocking number. Also, I'd like to point out today that the New Times had an article about the county's wastewater systems in Oceano called How to Polish a Turd. The Surfrider Foundation quoted that in their email broadcast today. And they want some people to come out and demonstrate against these outrageous costs. The same consultants that are doing those projects are also doing the Moore Bay project, which is very expensive as well. I wanted to show you today the earthquake damage in New Zealand to give you an idea. That was a 6.3 quake. Los Osos is sitting on a 6.8 quake and a 7.1 quake. You plan to put in a sewer that requires a slope of 1/16 of an inch to move that water and those solids. A quake would cause it to sway, sag, or most likely to rise because it's full of air most of the time. You would lose that collection system. I would also like to point out that I would have shown you a letter today from Adinas, who said that it is inappropriate to use that kind of technology in these conditions. We need a step stack system saving about 50%. Thank you.
Ms. Taylor, followed by Ben DeFada.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor, and I am a resident of Los Osos in the Prohibition Zone. The credibility of this board, the Water Board, and other entities are in question when statistics and information is printed or spoken and is not factual or is questionable. On the 8th of this month, I said the PUC approved a 48% increase for water rates in Los Osos, when in fact the PUC approved a 26.1 rate increase to begin in 2011, January, with the potential of an additional rate increase in July of this year, 2011. The public corrects misinformation. They give out. They try to keep facts straight. That is one of the very standout things of the person or persons who speak before this or any other board. The board and departments in this county are not making mistakes, but do not correct them. They make them. They're human, believe it or not. Correct information must be given out, and at our own facts in Los Osos is in economic distress, and our supervisor continues to gloss over this problem. We are in dire need of help out there. There are alternatives to gravity sewer systems that are much less costly and will accomplish what the Water Board seems to think we need. Let Los Osos see some courage and some common sense from this board. Do not approve a gravity sewer system that will bankrupt our community. If you think I'm joking, I certainly am not. And you must take serious consideration of the information that you put out, as well as what it is going to cost the community, because they need to have direct facts, not assumptions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Mr. DeFada, followed by Leon Golden.
Good morning, Chairman Hill, Board, Sheriff, Undersheriff, Deputy, Undercover Agents. I have people from Los Osos come here week after week from Los Osos to try to convince you to avert a catastrophe in this little town. After citizens of Los Osos in the past 4 years told you that there were major flaws in Supervisor Gibson's Gravity Sewer Project, he did make major changes to fine-tune the sewer project for the better. But the biggest change that needs to be changed is the most expensive component, the gravity collection. Mr. Gibson's Gravity Project is the most expensive sewer project in the nation. The question is that, knowing this, why is he and your board still pursuing gravity when better alternatives are available for many millions of dollars less? This course is reckless, irresponsible, abusive to our citizens, their families, and local businesses in and around the communities of Los Osos, where the future of several thousand people are at stake. Even after federal studies showed homeowners and renters in the prohibition zone are in an economically depressed situation, your board still continues on wasting time and money with this unaffordable project. With the state of today's and near future financial climate in this nation and state, your colleagues are still pursuing the most expensive gravity project, even to the point of encumbering people's properties to where thousands will eventually lose their homes because your board did not choose an affordable project. This affordable project will cause many homeowners and businesses in the zone to suffer financial ruination. At the regional water board a few weeks ago, Chairman Young's chin hit the desk when he heard what the near final costs were going to be when it was brought out by the public and other members of the board. Mr. Gibson was sweating bullets with his answers from questions the water board commissioners were asking of the many maybes that he hopes might come later. Meantime, he is taking a big gamble with our futures that he thinks maybe the good fairy will come to save the day. Meantime, all of you will be long gone, and so will half of Los Osos. Now we find out that Mr. Gibson is going to resurrect the gravity project plans of 6 years ago and deal with major changes as the construction continues along. This kind of thinking will cause costs to go even higher, with overruns and change notices added on to the final costs. Mr. Gibson could very well have resurrected the Ripley Pacific Company's proposal step plans that come about after the three Los Angeles COSD directors were thrown out on their heads, recalled in one shot for supporting the same unaffordable gravity project, which grew $95 million to $145 million overnight. Let's get on with this affordable step or vacuum collection project as soon as possible and get this nightmare over with. The people of Los Osos deserve better from you guys.
Mr. Golden, followed by Judge Golden.
Well, we're back with the sheriff again. Sorry about that. But until we get some answers, we're going to keep coming back. And among other things, I was kind of interested to note, because when I walked up to the building, the sheriff, who's now in the back of the room, arrived. And he parked his car in the no parking zone that's in front of the building. Raises a couple of questions. The sheriff's above the law, first question. Second question, we really have enough money to provide him with a car, to bring him here, to stand in the back, to protect us from whom? Is he being protected from me and the other contrarians who come here to try to convince you that there may be a better way of doing things? Or is the general public being protected from you? I try to get an answer to that. And I think we do need an answer, because it has what your lawyer will tell you, a chilling effect on some people coming here and expressing their opinions. There's no reason for the sheriff to be standing back there. None whatsoever. That car could have been out in service somewhere, taking care of what sheriffs generally do. And I note also that the sheriff is here, and there's another person in uniform who's seem to have enough stripes on him, so he must be an important person in the sheriff's department. And I imagine that they either have a place to park down below us or they walked over from wherever, but no car parked. Okay? Now, as far as the whole question of different subject on the sewer issue, which you have been considerably deaf to, and I recall over the years, over many years, back to when we had a shovel-ready project, and people who were in Washington lobbying to get us money for the shovel-ready project. Well, the term shovel-ready is gone, because it never was shovel-ready, as pointed out. And Mr. Gibson now would like to join a board which has whose chair has said that they're not responsible for saltwater intrusion, which will, of course, destroy the aquifer that the whole town of Los Osos draws from.
Thank you, Mr. Golden. Judge Golden, followed by Lindy Owen, please.
Good morning, Martha Golden. Well, there are so many issues and so little time. I'll try to focus very briefly on a couple of them. First of all, with respect to the people who come here all the time to talk about the sewer, reminds me of a story about an old man who went to the Wailing Wall every day for his 80 years, and after 70 years of wailing, because he was young when he started, but not an infant, a reporter asked him how he felt, what he talked about, and he talked about, oh, world peace and peace between Arabs and Jews and all of the important issues and end to poverty and so forth, and then the reporter said, well, after all this time, how do you feel about being at the Wailing Wall asking for all those issues? And he replied, oh, like hitting my head against a stone wall. And that's what the people of Los Osos who come here must feel like, hitting their heads against a stone wall. So much for the Los Osos sewer and the devastation it's going to wreak upon our community. The other thing that I want to talk about is a concept which seems to be strange to this board, and that's called free speech. It has become the pattern for the sheriff to come here and stand guard while the people speak. And it's always the people who are here for public comment or on days when there's an update on Los Osos. It will be here for the Los Osos project. When we were at the water board a few weeks ago, there, Mr. Gibson was there. It was a Los Osos update for the water board. And guess what? A highway patrolman stood in the back of the room and left when item 13, the water board issue on Los Osos, was over and everybody who had come to comment on Los Osos left the room. Isn't that interesting? Same thing happens here. Now, there are only a couple of ways of looking at this. One is that this board needs protection from the dangers of people who come here to express themselves freely and openly, sometimes carrying dangerous weapons besides their mouths. Sometimes they carry dangerous weapons like laptops, paper, pads, pencils, pens, really, really dangerous. And the other is that the budget of this county permits any number of law enforcement personnel to come here because it's such a comfortable surrounding with good sound, comfortable seats, and air conditionings. I personally believe that it is to intimidate people from coming here to address this board on issues of importance. I would like it to stop, personally. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Golden. Lindy Owen, followed by Eric Greening.
Good morning. Lindy Owen from Los Osos. And I think it's pretty common strategy when you're in political battle to malign one side by showing that they are aggressive and dangerous. And that is why we have a officer in the back. And he doesn't want to frisk me. I don't know. I come today to speak about 100 100 million and 25 reasons why you need to stop the direction that Mr. Gibson and Mr. Ogren have taken our sewer project, which was, we were asked to be patient, that everything would be looked at, and it wasn't. And that's why we're still coming every day. The 100 million reason is $100 million less money to put in a safer system. If you think that's enough to make people kind of go crazy, it is. But we're hanging in there, and we're still demanding that you have fiscal responsibility, you who took our project away from our community and have gone 4 years now and $8-plus million in debt coming up with something that you told us from the very beginning you would be putting in, which was a gravity sewer. Noel King announced that the very first day. So you have not done what you were supposed to do with us. I urge Assemblyman Sam Blakesley to get his rear end back into the process. 2701 was not followed. And we have to go to courts to get this resolved. And that is absurd, because the issue is absurd. The other issue is Los Osos. Everybody likes to talk about how bad their roads are in this county. Well, Los Osos is a great example. It's probably among the worst. And part of the reason it's among the worst is because the project has borrowed $2 million from our road fund. So for 4 years, we've had minimal repair. The irony is that when this awful project, if it were to go in, starts cutting holes down the middle of every street to go 18 feet under and put these gigantic pipes that will eventually break and leak raw sewage, the streets will be in such bad condition then that our sewer funds, we who have to pay for the sewer, will also have to pay to upgrade the roads, which have collapsed in the 5 to 6 years of complete neglect. So, there's no reason the step-steg pressurized small pipe collection does not tear up the streets. It goes on the side of the roads. It goes 4 to 5 feet under. It's flexible. It's directionally bored. There's a million and 25, maybe a million and 50 reasons why you do not want to put a gravity sewer in Los Osos.
Mr. Greening.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening. I'm not from Los Osos, and I'm not going to talk about Los Osos, so the deputy can relax for 3 minutes. I am going to talk about a press release put out by the Air Pollution Control District on February 18th. And it basically says that you, of course, are one of the three co-participants, or have been, in a memorandum of agreement relative to planning for the reduction of particulate matter coming off of the Oceano Dunes. And your board took action to participate in that memorandum of agreement. And this press release says that the joint memorandum of agreement to work together on reducing particulate matter emissions from the Oceano Dunes State Vehicular Recreation Area will be dissolved and replaced with a more streamlined process. It says, under a more streamlined process, state parks will oversee the efforts of the technical experts to implement the three pilot projects, with APCD and the county providing input and guidance throughout the duration. It says that the long-term PM reduction plan will then be developed. In other words, there are three pilot projects, presumably quickly, going in soon. And then a long-term reduction plan will then be developed by technical experts overseen by state parks in consultation with the APCD and the county. This is a considerable change from three co-equal participants at the table participating in the TAC and the MOC to one lead participant advised by, with the two other participants looking over their shoulders. Given that when the county entered into this, it took an action by your board to do this. I'm wondering how we can have a press release now saying that the county is a party to the dissolution without your board actually having a public hearing to decide whether this agreement will be dissolved. I don't see why this agreement isn't still in force until or unless your board and the APCD board can act on it. So I am asking for a public hearing, and I'm certainly asking for some clarification about the county and how the county's constituents can have a continuing role in this process. The county is responsible on two sides. It is a co-polluter by virtue of owning the La Grande tract, and it has a health department, a health officer, and is responsible for the health of the people. And so it has a critical role in this, a keystone role. I'm sorry to see it losing its keystone position. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. And finally, last public comment, Dr. C. Height.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos. I try to make this request every year prior to decisions being made on the budget. And I make this request because I was reading the ADA in the law library when the librarian came over and handed me some updates. And at that point, it occurred to me that the board may be getting advisement and making decisions without a clear understanding of how the laws have changed to try to protect the rights and the basic survival of handicapped people. So I make the request that you turn to your council and to your administrator and ask them to please check the updates on the ADA before, so that you can make an informed decision on budget cuts. So the upcoming budget is not based on putting the burden of our hard economic times on those least able to survive it. I am knocking on the door of opportunity. We are knocking on the door of opportunity, and that door won't open. Some people just fall through the cracks. It is an excuse that is meant to explain the unexplainable. Some people just fall through the cracks. And when they don't fall easily, they are pushed and shoved, kicking and screaming the whole way. Some people just fall through the cracks. The outrage here is that the senior disabled fixed income residents of Los Osos are predestined to fall through the cracks. When did a person or people ever fail to speak up about a real or perceived threat to their home? And what will happen to them when they speak up? Defamation is the gift that keeps on giving. Will those who have been defamed publicly to their face be defamed behind closed doors? Will applications and complaint processes that can save our homes just not come to us in time? Will we be offered less than what was available before we asserted our rights and complained? Let me be the example. Let my humiliation... My humiliation is your shame, because the attitude of disrespect begins at the top. It filters down. Tell the service providers of this county, over the TV, over the radio, over the computer, that when you defamed the people of Los Osos, you didn't mean me. I'm giving you your second opportunity. Now, we celebrated Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. He is a man who spoke up, and people came up with all kinds of reasons of what he was and what he was trying to do. But we survived those times. Don't defame us because we speak up. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height. That will close public comment. We'll bring it back to the board. Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just make a couple comments relative to Mr. Greening's questions and statements today. I'll speak both as the chair this year of the APCD board and also a member of this board. First of all, the memorandum of agreement on moving forward on actions to reduce particulate matter on the dunes accomplished quite a lot. We have gotten technical experts on board and pilot projects in the pipeline that we fully expect to have on the ground. But as we looked at the mechanics of getting these decisions made, APCD staff and some subcommittee of board members did feel that it was a complex process and that there was a faster way to get to the to solutions to the questions and answers that we needed. And so really what we're doing is redistributing or simply going back to assigning to each party in this complex process those responsibilities that are rightfully theirs. The one piece that's in that press release that Eric didn't quote from the lectern is that the APCD is moving forward with rulemaking on fugitive dust emissions from the dunes. And that is the proper role of the APCD. We are regulators and protectors of the public health. So as state parks and, indeed, the county as a landowner within that off-road vehicle area moves forward with plans to reduce fugitive dust emissions, the APCD is going to be moving forward with a rule to be sure that dust emissions do not exceed the standards to which we're held to meet. So we found that if we just assigned those duties to each of the entities, we would get, I think, a more efficient process. Yes, there will be public discussion, both at this board and at APCD, as we move forward under the new system. I do believe we will have to take formal action to dissolve the MOU, so there will be an opportunity for discussion of how we're going to move forward on this. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. We will be moving into our consent agenda, and I do have some requests from the public to speak on specific items on the consent agenda. Mike Brown, followed on A1, followed by Richard Margetson on A1.
Morning, supervisors. You have a request from the governor's appointment secretary to nominate someone to the Coastal Commission. You already have a representative, Council Member Reese, who has been there and who has indicated her willingness to stay. So you might want to consider that from the standpoint of local control here. You know, the Coastal Commission has a long record, a long historical record of staff domination. The members turn over, the staff stays there. I think its executive director has been there for decades and decades. It is well known that it is against local control, that it goes far beyond its mandate of expanding and protecting public access to the coast.
Mr. Brown, could you speak to the item on the agenda, which is not your opinion of the Coastal Commission and other pontifications of regulatory bodies, but the actual request to appoint from...
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's just context for my comment. But I think in terms of candidates for possible nomination to the commission, there are some questions that anybody who's being considered to be there ought to be asked with respect to how they would approach their role on the commission. And one question would be, if you're appointed, how are you going to deal with the property rights issue that's often an issue raised in Coastal Commission matters? How are you going to promote local control on the commission? How are you going to try to bring the staff of the commission under control? Because these appointments are from counties and cities and are supposed to represent the local people. So I would respectfully suggest that there's a huge issue. As you know, there have been lawsuits in the past. As you know, this is a commission that has created severe problems, and I would ask those questions of any candidates. Thank you very much.
Mr. Brown, thank you. Mr. Margetson, followed by Leon Golden on A1 still.
Richard Margetson, I noticed again there was no response to public comment about the sheriff. I know this is a formality. I know what you're going to do. But my concern about this item is Mr. Gibson was elected as a supervisor from District 2. His first and foremost responsibility is to District 2. Wasn't on the ballot that he was running for District 2 and a possible appointment to some commission down the road. He was voted in as a supervisor of District 2. And I look on his resume. Under local boards, he's on LAFCO. He's the chair of the Council of Governments. He's also the chair of the Air Pollution Control District. And he's on the Integrated Waste Management Authority and the Adult Services Policy Council. Now, I know just related to supervisors' issues, the packets that you gentlemen have to review weekly are usually a couple inches thick. How many more inches of documents is he going to have to look at dealing with a Coastal Commission appointment on top of all the other chairs that he currently holds? Some of the Coastal Commission items, as an example, the Los Osos issue, 6,000 pages. Does an appointment to the Coastal Commission dilute his ability to serve the district he was elected to? So things don't get missed in the future for his main responsibility, which is supervisor to the second district. As example, will further things get missed in Los Osos, like bus stop benches being placed in the wrong spots, San Isabel project that is over $1 million now and is an absolute joke, retrofit ordinances that still have not come back for review years after they were supposed to be on the docket for review with your massive schedule that you guys have with half your meetings not even having an afternoon session, and the number of contacts that a coastal commissioner has from the public. Some coastal commissioners spend 2-3 hours a day talking to representatives on issues that are going to be before them, plus the thousands of pages he's going to have to review. Is an appointment to this commission doing this county and his district the proper service? Thank you.
Mr. Golden, followed by Jan Marks on A1.
Well, I don't want to take your time unnecessarily this morning, so I'm going to be short. First of all, I agree and second everything that Mr. Margetson has said. I do want to correct an error I made earlier today in not referring to the fact that Mr. Gibson was putting his name forward for being on the Coastal Commission. I don't recall exactly what I said, but it was not, I did not mention the Coastal Commission. I'm also concerned about one other part, and that is in Mr. Gibson's handout that which comes with his letter asking you to send a letter urging that he be appointed, he states that he's led significant efforts to develop, permit, and finance the Los Osos wastewater project. A protracted effort to install a sewer system will halt significant pollution of Morro Bay National Estuary and the Los Osos groundwater basin. Now, I tell you, sorry, but I'm a contrarian on that one. I don't think that will pass muster, because I don't think that has been done. We have the continual problem of saltwater intrusion. We have all sorts of other problems which have been mentioned to you over and over again. And unlike the bus stop, which Richard referred to, we've not been successful. And on the bus stop, it took coming here three times and going to other commissions at least twice, but we finally got the bus stop fixed. I think that Mr. Gibson would do well to try to represent his district.
Jan Marks, followed by Marianne Reese. Madam Mayor.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm just here to ask you to add my name to your list of recommended candidates for the Coastal Commission. I have, at present, I am serving as mayor of San Luis Obispo, and the governor has asked both the City Selection Committee and the County Board of Supervisors to submit at least one name in each of those categories. And so I would like to respectfully ask if you would add my name to the city, to the list of city candidates. It's my understanding that Governor Brown wants a wide selection of candidates to make a choice from. Last time around, for some reason, our county and our city selection committee was under the impression that they could only put forward one name in each of those categories, and actually that's been clarified. It's at least one candidate. So I think the more candidates we have from the city of from the county of San Luis Obispo, the greater chance there is that the governor will pick someone from our county. I do think that Supervisor Gibson would make a great coastal commissioner. I think I also am qualified to serve in that position by virtue of the fact that I've been following coastal issues closely since 1995, and first started on the County Parks and Recreation Commission, and was involved with helping the county accept numerous offers to dedicate access to the coast. I really believe in the Coastal Act, and I hope that you will find it in your discretion, that you will find it acceptable to add me to the list. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor Marks. Councilmember Reese?
Actually, I'm only present to see if you had any questions at all, but I do want to point out that I have been serving on the Coastal Commission, and in the beginning as Assemblyman Asajian's alternate. And I did serve at two meetings at that point in time, and then afterward I was appointed as the commissioner, and I've served another three meetings, which means that I've actually spent 15 days on that commission. Each of those meetings take at least 2.5 days. It does take a lot of time. That is one of the reasons why I did not run for mayor again, and to make time to serve on this commission. And I am probably one of the more centrist type representatives on that commission, and I want to point out that I am the only council member who's applied for this nomination who does represent a coastal city. The others do not represent a coastal city, but I'm available for any questions that you might have, and I have a huge interest in continuing to serve, so I would appreciate your nomination.
Okay. I see no questions, but we will gladly, if voted on, submit your, okay. your letter forward.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Eric Greening, followed by Dr. C. Height.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening. You have a number of strong candidates, and I just do have one question for Mr. Gibson before you make your final choice. I treasure his role as chair of Council of Governments and Regional Transit Authority. Obviously, I very much depend on the Regional Transit Authority, so that's a very important role. It's fairly unusual, but not unheard of, for the Coastal Commission to meet at the same time as the Council of Governments or the RTA, particularly in July when things tend to get bumped by the holiday. It's certainly not unheard of, probably would happen once or twice a year. The biggest concern I have is the conflict with the executive committee, the RTA and or SLOCOG executive committee. There's one or the other or both each month, normally on second Wednesdays, and that is an almost invariable conflict with the Coastal Commission meeting. And so my question is, would the executive committee be important enough to Mr. Gibson that he would leave the Coastal Commission in the hands of his alternate to carry on that particular duty before catching up with the meeting? I do consider that a very important local role, and I would hate to lose him from that local role. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Dr. Height, followed by Al Barrow, and that will close A1's comments.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos, A1. Marianne Reese raises some good points, and good that people come forward and speak. And on the issue of attentiveness to the job, for the record, this was not just a wrong bus stop. It was a waste of public funds putting a bus stop that was not ADA compliant on top of a storm drain culvert.
Dr. Height, could you please speak to the item?
I'm speaking to the item. I'm speaking to the attention that individuals pay to their community. And you have made a recommendation for Supervisor Gibson, and I'm not going to bring in any other issues of what he believes in for our community. Otherwise, that there has been some neglect. What I want to bring is that I think that the Coastal Commission is an awesome responsibility. And I've been following the Coastal Commission since a child that used to visit Dana Point, which we had a Coastal Commission, and yet that area, that entire marine environment was destroyed for the purpose of pleasure boats. So my issue about recommending Gibson would be that I would be very much objecting to electing a commissioner who has already demonstrated the intention to limit public speech on issues. That is my major concern, not his position on Los Osos Sewer, pro or con, but the intention. And we have a public record of this, of repeatedly trying to limit public speech on issues to a coastal community, but more, I think, frightening would be the word, is the public record in which this individual suggested that the chairman of the board could meet with him outside of these meetings and that he would give him some tips. And I mean, that's a public record, and I thought, gee, what's the suggestion here? Tips to limit public speech? I mean, this was really pretty outrageous. And I think the sensitivity that is needed for this job, and a recommendation leaves open the possibility of the job, is an individual that will listen to their community and to the public and not spend their energy trying to limit public opinion. Thank you.
Mr. Barrow?
Could you show my... Madam Clerk, could you show my presentation? Is that possible? It's on, hooked up. My name is Al Barrow. My first meetings with Mr. Gibson, when I contacted him when he was director of the Land Conservancy, and I practically begged him to map the Esha in the prohibition zone of Los Osos, which is very sensitive habitat. He refused to do that. I was a weed puller at the time at the Elvin Forest, and we'd go out Saturdays and pull belt grass. So I found I'm not getting my presentation.
We have several presentations lined up, I think, is the problem, Mr. Barrow. So I don't.
My presentation's not up.
It's not on that computer. It's on his computer.
Look.
And it's not coming through.
Oh.
Anyway, I'm speaking to this appointment because I feel like the applicant has baggage that shouldn't be carried to the Coastal Commission. Right now, the Surfrider Foundation, other people have appeals to the plant in Morro Bay that's being proposed. And I don't think that Mr. Gibson's position really represents the position of the people in the community. We see complaints about a wastewater project. Am I not going to get my presentation up? Is that what's going on?
It's not working, Mr. Barrow.
I'm sorry?
It's not working.
Mr. Gibson broke many promises. I don't think when somebody's willing to break promises that they are a good candidate for an important position like Coastal Commissioner. Mr. Gibson, you told us that you were going to give a fair, equal analysis of SEPSAG and gravity, that we would have a, if we agreed for a $25,000 assessment, that we would get a competitive bidding between SEPSAG and gravity. These are really huge issues for us financially and environmentally. You just took those off the table. And when we asked you over and over again, you said, well, we're not going to talk about it. It's over. It's over. That's not a reasonable approach to dealing with controversial matters. I don't think Mr. Gibson has the mental attitude to be fair, and I think he's easily influenced by powerful interests. So I just wanted to register that when he goes to the Coastal Commission, that he brings that baggage with him. Thank you.
Okay, that's all for A1. Mr. Honeycutt has a present. Let me make a couple of comments on A1 too. To Mayor Marks, I did not receive your CV and letter in time to put it on the agenda. I've been advised by our county council we can't add it to the agenda today, so we will put it on a future agenda and submit it to the governor's office as well. So I think it's likely to be March 8th agenda. Right now, what we had in time was Supervisor Gibson's letter and CV and Councilmember Reese's letter and CV. So we will gladly submit yours as well. Also, on the other, before we go to Mr. Honeycutt, despite a handful of rather petty personal grudges against Mr. Gibson, it's clear by the June election where Mr. Gibson was reelected by 70% of the vote that most of the people, quite a lot of the people, are confident in his abilities and the job he's doing. So, Mr. Honeycutt, if you could, please. A2.
Good morning. My name is Frank Honeycutt with County Public Works. Wanted to speak to item A2. Fortunately, this will be the last time I need to come to you and talk about the emergency slope repair on Avo Beach Drive. I got a slide. See how quickly I can get through these. This, you've seen this before. As an aerial view shows the three areas that were of concern. This was site 2 near the pump station about halfway down Avo Beach Drive, or sometimes called Hartford Drive. We had a concern before we can even get to this, about half the concern, the slope came down. you can see this is what it would look like now or a couple weeks ago. We've removed all of the soil or material that we thought would come down. Since this picture was taken, we have prepped this slope to take the rains that came, and it'll look even better this summer. We refer to as Site 1. This part of the project was bigger than the rest of the site. Combined, there's unstable soil there up on the top. You can see in the hatched area identified by our geotechnical consultant. If you look pretty well to the center of the picture, you could see the area that was removed. The material that was removed was mostly put there at the bottom of the slope, compacted. And these pictures, three of them were taken last week as we had crews out there preparing those slopes for the rain. It's hard to tell in this picture, but if you look just slightly above and to the left of the word site, you can see a crack developing in the soil. It was really bright on my computer. I guess it's kind of dark here. We noticed the While we were out there one morning, there was a crack developing. By the time I got out there mid-morning, the crack was much larger. It was clear that this soil was going to come down too, probably as a result of some of the other excavation. So that was the primary cause for the other part of the request of today's action, is that you increase our authorization to cover that additional work. Finally, there's a lot of people we need to thank on this. There are a lot of people who had to drop what they're doing to deal with this urgent matter, particularly Port of San Luis, PG&E, and also one of the adjoining property owners, Beachfront Resort. We also had a number of staff people. Joe Whalen was our resident engineer, and Scott Wetmore were the inspector. Without having time to prepare plans and specs, these people had to be on the job every day to direct the work. Some of the work had to exceed the right-of-way. Our right-of-way people took care of that matter in a matter of days, which normally took weeks. And then you saw him in one of the pictures there, Rich Rose, is our genius when it comes to erosion control. He was out there. He also happens to be very good at working with prison crews, if you notice all those orange jumpsuits, put those people to work. And then finally, Eric Weir in our environmental division made sure that we were doing everything in a compliant manner. And so with that, if you have any questions, thank you for your support on this throughout the 2 months.
Mr. Honeycutt, I really appreciate the work that you and your staff and the crews have done much quicker than you had originally estimated when you came to my advisory council, and really do appreciate that. I know the residents of Avila, visitors, and people who work in the area are very appreciative of the quick and terrific response, too. So please pass our thanks on to all of your staff.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Thank you. That closes it to public comment on consent, and I'll bring it back to the board and see if we have any comments to make from our colleagues. Mr. Teixeira.
Good, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Patterson.
Yes, if I may, Mr. Chair, a quick comment on item A1.
Okay. Mr. Gibson?
None, sir.
Okay. Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out that the Coastal Commission was established by a voter-initiated Coastal Act, and they're charged with protecting California's 1,300-mile coastline in a consistent manner. And I think they've done that remarkably well over the last few decades and hope they continue to do that. And in response to some of the folks questioning the ability of Supervisor Gibson to maintain both his local responsibilities as well as that of the Coastal Commission, should he be appointed to the Coastal Commission, I have great confidence in Mr. Gibson's ability to do both, as well as Ms. Reese's, and I'm quite comfortable with the nominations going forward. And again, Ms. Marks, we can act on your request today for reasons, Chairman Hill mentioned, and if you want to bring that forward, we can put that on a future agenda. So with that, I move the approval of the consent agenda.
Second.
Okay. Moved by Supervisor Patterson, second by Supervisor Gibson. Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes. Thank you. We will move into our items. We'll begin with A3, and Mr. Grant, did you want to begin?
Yes, thank you very much. Jim Grant, County Administrator. This morning we do have three items for discussion with your board. The first one is the fiscal year 2011-12 budget update, and as you know, we've been working with departments for the last couple of months working through. They've actually been working through submitting their budget for next year that starts June or July 1st. The next, we will have a budget update on the new women's jail project, and then we'll close it out by having a discussion and reviewing the redistricting process that will be in place later in the upcoming months. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Assistant County Administrator Dan Buckshy to lead us through the budget.
Mr. Buckshy, how are you?
Good, thank you. Good morning. As Mr. Grant noted, I'm going to cover the budget update. We are not seeking any direction from your board at this point. This is an informational update, a status check, if you will. And three things that I'm going to cover is the current gap, the assumptions, what the impacts are at a high level, how we're going to the plan to move forward based upon all the prior action that your board has taken. Then the second part will be some longer-term revenue options for your consideration. This is something that was discussed about 3 years ago, and thought it was time to just bring it back to your board's attention again. No action is required at this point. And then lastly, a state budget update. I do have some new information, not a whole lot, and depending upon how your board would like to proceed, I'll obviously review the new information, but I can rehash some of what we had covered in January as well in terms of the local impacts, but not a whole lot of info there at this point. So with that, let's jump into the upcoming budget year and what we're looking at, just to set the stage. The same definition and approach that we've used for a few years is we take a look for the upcoming year 11-12. We're looking at just the general fund, not the other funds that comprise the total county budget. And more or less, we assume that we continue to do what we do. We don't add anything new. We don't delete anything in the current or in the new year. And that last point there, that if there are any reductions in state or federal funding, that we offset an equal amount of expenditure that we don't backfill with local dollars. If we do, it just adds to the budget gap. So that's the foundation, if you will. And what we're looking at is the October forecast was 9 to 15 million, and at this point we've narrowed it to 11.5 to 14. And the reason for that range, as was noted in the staff report, is we had assumed fund balance available initially at $14.5 million. And fund balance available is the money that's left over at 1 year that can be used in the upcoming year. After reviewing it more closely, we're thinking it might be a little higher, maybe along the lines of upwards of $17 million, but we don't know for sure. So that would drop the budget gap. We'll have more detailed information. The auditor's office will do a more detailed calculation around the second week of March, and then we never truly know what FBA will be until the books close in July and we get an update in August. So it's always an estimate that is usually the portion of the budget that swings the most. It's the outcome of the variance between every single line item in the budget, and there are over 2,000 different line items. So, I guess the good news is the forecast is accurate. Unfortunately, it's to the mid or high side as opposed to the low side or under. But with that, the approach overall, similar to prior years, the idea is to maintain as many programs and services as possible, and yet continue to operate in a fiscally sound manner so that we can continue to provide those programs into the future and that we don't just push off some difficult decisions down the road. Going into that, one of the challenges that makes the budget process both interesting and challenging is all the different inputs that go into creating that balance. As you can see here, this is just a snapshot. It's about most we could fit onto one slide and keep it legible. There are other inputs. The board's priorities, community input, advisory bodies and commissions, budget balancing strategies and approaches, state, local, federal mandates, state, federal, local laws, master plans, and the like. And, again, is to try to receive all that input and strike that balance point. Ideally, we'd be able to achieve everybody's desires and wants and needs in terms of their input. I think these days, under the circumstances, that we hope that everybody can at least tolerate what's brought forward, given that there's not enough money to do everything. So what are we looking at in terms of assumptions? Again, starting with the foundation, we are still seeing that we think we're near the bottom as far as revenues go. The rate of loss, year-over-year decline of revenues has stopped or receded a bit. Some areas we're seeing a little bit of an uptick. The economy is improving a bit. I don't think as quickly as anybody would like. But a good example is sales tax. We'll see a couple good months that'll pick up, and we get hopeful that there's a trend that's developing, and then we'll see a couple months where it ticks back down. So it's up and down, but generally along the bottom. So that's the approach we've taken in terms of the revenue assumptions. We did include the repayment of the Los Osos loan to the general fund by the end of the current fiscal year. And then the last point on this slide is it assumes a 4% contingency. The general board budget policy is for a 5% contingency. We did lower it intentionally to 4 during the 2009-10 budget year. As an example, if we did go back to 5, it would add about $4 million to the gap. So we're not suggesting that we do that at this point in time. The other two assumptions, this first one will be rather tricky and will require considerable coordination and likely some changes down the road. State budget, what to assume given the current state of flux and the magnitude of the issues facing the state. What we've done in some instances where there are specific cuts, such as library, veteran services, and a handful of smaller other issues, we've built those in for now. That may change and we'll obviously update as we move forward. What is not included is the proposal to realign about $6 billion worth of programs from the state to California's 58 counties. We simply do not have enough information. We don't even know if it's going to move forward for certain at this point in time. It's just a proposal that's being batted around. Obviously, if that goes through, we will have to make some adjustments. We just don't know to what extent or when at this point. And then lastly, federal stimulus funding, that is something that did help us out the last couple years. That is winding down. Not all of the money has been spent, but it has been encumbered, and we are not budgeting any new money for 11-12. Do you always have every year additional requests? We, as part of the budget process, we do ask departments, what are some of the unmet needs that are out there? What do you think you need to meet your customers' requirements? 23 requests, total about $3.5 million, of which a little more than $2 million would be from the general fund. Now, obviously, given the fiscal constraints, a number of these would not be able to be funded, but it is important to note that even in prior years, when things were difficult, that some of these were funded. That is, business conditions change, new mandates, different funding ratios, that sort of thing. Some of these have been funded, and I would anticipate that at least a few would be considered for funding and likely to be funded in the upcoming year as well, so we'll have to keep that in consideration. So where are we in terms of our what's become known as the 7-year pain plan? It was previously the 5-year plan, and unfortunately revenues have not picked up at the rate we had previously anticipated, so it's 7 years. We're right at the midpoint. You can see the $11.5 to $14 million gap, hopefully winnowing that down over the next 3 years and reaching structural balance in fiscal year 14-15. The idea, as you can see, illustrated by this next slide, is to funnel down the amount of short-term options that are used. Again, a decision by your board a few years ago is to use some short-term options and then gradually close the structural balance. The idea behind the short-term options is to mitigate the amount of program and service level impacts and to potentially to avoid layoffs to the extent possible. And we've been largely successful in doing that. But again, to wean ourselves from that short-term money and, again, achieve a structural balance out in 14-15. If we did that, if you look at the two ends of the expected gap, and if we stick with the plan to use 20% of short-term, we would need to come up with between a little over $9 million and $11 million of ongoing expenditure reductions, which is certainly less than prior years. Obviously, the slide prior showed that we've closed gaps of 18, 30, and 17 million dollars, so it is shrinking, but it's still going to be difficult. The approach again in doing that is we asked all departments as a starting point, submit your status quo budget and then also submit reductions that meet the specified targets. You can see here it does vary. Public safety, being one of your board's highest priorities, was asked to cut less. This still does have significant impacts, but obviously not as much as if they were asked to cut more. Health agency and roads at 10 and 25%. The reason those numbers are bigger tie into one of the budget balancing strategies that we reduce the amount of overmatch. And just to rehash that briefly, overmatch is a situation where the federal and state government provides funding, then we're required to provide a local match. During the good times, even, the federal and state funding did not keep up with the cost of expenditures. We had the local revenues at the time to backfill some of that, to cover for those expenditures, and that was particularly the case in the health agency to keep those programs going and not cut those. There are a lot of important programs. However, we can't afford to do that, so one of the strategies is to dial that back in a methodical fashion over the next 4 years and ultimately over a 7-year time frame. And then everybody else was asked to submit a budget to minus 5%. Now, that does not mean that everybody would go to these figures. It's a starting point. The idea is that we review those impacts to service levels, discuss those with your board, and then staff will make a recommendation of trying to find that balance point that I referenced earlier. What does it look like in terms of positions if we did implement to the full extent? In the status quo budget, departments are saying that they would eliminate 8.5 positions, and then the cut list obviously total another 56, so we get to just under 65 positions, or about 2.5% of the workforce that would need to be dialed back over this time frame. Looking over the cumulative effects, going back to 08-09, which was the first year of difficult budgets, you can see that the cumulative impact would be about 280 positions, or 11% of the workforce, and that is a significant amount of lost capacity. Now, again, one of the balancing strategies is try to minimize the amount of layoffs, and to this point, nobody has been laid off as a result of the budget. We have been able to achieve this staff reduction via attrition, which is one of the goals. Whether or not we'll be able to achieve that in 11-12 remains to be seen, but we'll certainly do what we can. So, diving into the approaches, how are we going to tackle this? Well, we're planning on using similar strategies that have been employed. Again, a multi-year approach, and then careful use of the short-term options. You know, the case study of what not to do with short-term options is the state, and that's why they're wrestling with the $25 billion budget gap that seems too big to wrestle with. It's because the short-term options were overused, and we don't want to mirror that here locally. What are the long-term options? First and foremost, we will follow your board's priorities in creating a proposed budget for your consideration later this year, and I'll speak to the priorities in a few minutes. All departments will participate. Your board felt it was important that even though there are different priority levels, that everybody participate, that we're all in this together and nobody is essentially let off the hook. Proportional reductions during the boom times. Some departments and operations grew more quickly. There was a big rise in demand, big rise in revenue, and staffing was added in order to meet that demand, and since that time, the bottom's fallen out of the economy, and in some cases, the demand and revenues have dropped, and we're scaling back some of those operations more significantly than others. Mid-year reductions, we've done this for a number of years now. If we receive some updated information from the state and have to adjust our budget, we do so and have done so, and I already spoke to the overmatch. And then I'll speak more a little bit later, but one of the key strategies is to engage the employee associations, and that has been done and is ongoing as we speak. Short-term options, hiring chill. This has been in place now since October of 2007, so 2.5 years, or 3.5 years. Every request to fill has to be personally approved by Mr. Grant, the CAO, and only the exceptions are typically made for if it's clearly related to health and safety, or if there is funding along with that position or some other special need. Otherwise, the positions are held vacant so that we can work through scaling down the operations and utilize attrition as much as possible. Again, some of the other short-term things, deferring capital and maintenance, reducing organizational development. Going back to capital and maintenance, again, this is a balance point. It's much like owning a house or a car, that when times get a little tight, you put things off, but you know that if you do put it off too long, it'll end up costing more in the long run, and you'll have more problems on your hands, and that's something that we want to avoid, so we're carefully looking at that.
Yeah, I want to make a point there. We are deferring some of those things, but other items we do still have budgeted to make sure that in our capital side and our automation side, we are taking care of some of those items that we need to, so that we haven't decimated the whole thing. We are continuing on with a lesser program than we have in the last few years, but nonetheless, we are still dealing with some of those issues.
Yep. Good point. And then moving on, we have utilized voluntary time off. Several employees have volunteered for this over the years, and in the past, about $500,000 a year has been budgeted in voluntary time off to help ease budget issues. Mentioned federal stimulus funding. In the past, early retirement has been an option. Don't know if that's anything we'd consider at this point. More to be discussed on that. And then obviously the use of short-term, of one-time reserves to help balance the budget as well. So board priorities. As your board is well aware, to meet legal mandates, keep our creditors hold so that we can issue debt in the future, and then public safety as defined by these four operations. And again, this will be one of the roadmaps, if you will, as we move forward in creating a staff proposal for your board. So just wanted to talk a little bit about the framework and two of the challenges that we'll be dealing with. So the framework The way this works in most cases is departments receive specific revenue. This is usually in the form of fees and charges for services, as well as state and federal revenue. And departments have their expenditures. And in most cases, the expenditures are more than the departmental revenue, and that difference is funded with what is called general fund support. The general fund support is then funded by non-departmental revenue, which is essentially property tax, sales tax, hotel tax, that sort of thing, plus FBA less contingency. Netted out, this equates to around $147, $148 million that's available to fund the bottom line for that differential. So the challenge that moving forward, and we've reviewed this in the past, is if you look at 07-08, the last of the good years, the four public safety departments that I just referenced accounted for a little more than a third of that available general fund support. The other three departments you can see listed, health agency, social services, and roads, means that out of the 22 departments, the other 15 represented just under 40%. We flash forward 3 years, that dynamics change. Public safety has grown from a little over a third to just under half. The other three are close to where they've been. And then the other 15 departments have dropped from 39% to 32%. So one of the challenges will be how to, as we move forward these next few years, again, how to strike that balance with public safety being a high priority, but yet it'll become increasingly difficult to balance the budget more or less with the focal point being on the 15 other departments, given that they represent a smaller piece of the budget. The additional challenge as well, not surprisingly, we're a service organization. Salaries comprise about 60%. If we adjust for some pass-through funds such as social service payments and public health support, capital projects and the like, that gets closer to the high 60s. That's in the normal range. Typically in California counties and cities, it's anywhere from 60 to 80% of the budget is in salaries. And that being the case, we have to address that. We can't balance the budget without addressing labor costs. So staff is in the midst of implementing the three-point compensation plan that your board has directed staff to pursue. The first is pension cost sharing, with the ultimate goal that the county and employees, existing employees, would split existing pension costs 50-50. That a second-tier pension be put in place for new employees, and your board and management have led the way on this. This was in effect as of January 1st, and we are working with all of the other unions to try to get a second tier in place. And this is critical. As we move forward, as folks retire or move out of the existing tier one into tier two, it essentially cuts pension costs in half, which over time as we migrate, that's over $25 million of annual savings that will be realized when we get most employees into the second tier. So that's huge in terms of future strategies to balance the budget. Then lastly, to look at the prevailing wage ordinance and how that's been interpreted over the years, and to make a more concerted effort to do wage studies that more reflect the marketplace more broadly than what we've done in the past. And again, we are in the midst of implementing all three of those points in the compensation plan. Where we're at in the overall financial planning and budget cycle. We're over on the left-hand side of the ongoing cycle of life, if you will. Here, departments just submitted their budgets to the administrative office about 2 weeks ago. They began working on this in mid-December, submitted in early February. We have begun this review and are working with departments to understand their submittals and understand the various ramifications for the different options. More specifically, we'll be doing that between now and early April. At that point, we need to pin down the numbers by early April so that then we can begin actually publishing this large document. It takes a few weeks to write all this up and double-check all the facts and figures for accuracy and have that available by early May so that we can introduce it to your board and the public, usually by mid-May at the latest, and which is about a month prior to budget hearings for mid-June. So that's the timeline that we're dealing with at this point in time. And as far as part one of the presentation goes, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, a few questions up here, Mr. Buckshy. Supervisor Patterson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a few questions, and You make reference to our debt service as one of the primary things that we have to deal with first, and I'm curious to know what our debt is currently and what our debt service is. Do you have an update on that?
Yeah, I may ask Mr. Seebach to help me out with this one if he knows off the top of my head. But on an annual basis, so I believe where we're at is in terms of the operating budget around 3 or 4%. I don't recall off the top of my head what the total outstanding debt is. The target is to keep that at around 5% or less of the operating budget. So we are within what we would consider reasonable parameters at this point in time.
Jerry Seebach, Auditor Controller. I believe our annual debt service cost is around the 4% of the general fund. We could get that exact number in a few minutes if you want us to come back. We can do that.
That'd be great.
It's I think our policy has been to try to keep it below 5%. Then if you get over that, then the bond market starts looking at you as a heavy debt burden and less creditworthy.
I see. And we've consistently maintained that status of debt.
Absolutely.
Being less than 5%.
Yes. So. We're on the low end of most of our comparable counties, I believe.
Would that be large? I guess my question following up on that, Mr. Seebach, would be do we compare well in our debt service obligation to many of our other counties?
Yes, to my knowledge, yes. I think there's one of the performance measures in there that calls for that, measures that.
And another question that Mr. Seebach may have the answer to. If you don't, Mr. Buckshy, I'm curious, you also make reference in your staff report to the federal stimulus funding, the ARRA funding, the Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And I know that our county has been a recipient of quite a bit of that money, and I'm curious to know how much we've received from the federal government, which is one-time money, I realize, but also is there more to come?
Yeah, break that into two categories, and we'll provide a very detailed update to your board as part of the second quarter report with more information. But off the top of my head, obviously, we received the working on the low-interest loan for Los Osos, which off the top of my head I believe was around $80 million. Setting that aside, the other types of fund for other operations I believe has totaled about $12 million, and most of that has been either encumbered, a portion of it spent, not a large portion of it spent. We want to get moving on spending that money. And no, there is not anything planned to be budgeted for 11-12. That program's expiring. In fact, I believe there's some talk in Washington about spending it quickly or potentially losing it if we're not able to do that. So we are not planning to build any additional in for 11-12. It's simply not available. The program's winding down. It was intended to help stimulate the economy during the downturn, and folks are believing that has run its course.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. And I know you and others have been working with the applicants of the large solar projects out on the eastern part of the county. And should those projects be approved and construction begin, I believe there's some revenue anticipated from those projects. Do you have any idea how that will be coming in and how much that'll be?
Yeah, in total, if both projects were approved, you know, per the current plans, the sales tax during that period should be in the $20 to $25 million range. That would flow in through the construction period, depending how long that takes. And it really depends on the timing of the materials as it flows. We typically receive sales tax, and there's about a one-quarter lag, so it flows relatively quickly as far as that goes. Now, the question is what to do with that money when it comes in, and there's been discussion about the fire station out in Carrizo Plain increasing staffing, not only during the construction period but in the longer term, and that's a fairly substantial cost to the tune of $500,000 to $600,000 a year of ongoing cost. And so some of the discussion has been, would we carve out that sales tax, set it aside to help fund for that, or just build that into the general budget, the cost of the fire station, if it's determined to keep those augmented levels. But so, you know, depending on when construction gets underway, probably, you know, a year from now we might start seeing some of that money trickle in.
Okay, so likely nothing for this fiscal year or this coming fiscal year, the 11th.
Seems like we might see some towards the end, but at this point we haven't built it in, given that we don't have enough information. That's something we could revisit depending how the process goes moving forward.
Very good. Thank you. That concludes my questions, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm always impressed with the effort that our departments put into this particular bit of our work. It's truly remarkable. I appreciate you bringing down the last year's, I guess it was the final budget. The heft of that document is truly remarkable, and especially in difficult times, the efforts of the departments to prioritize the adjustments that they're going to have to make is greatly appreciated. Relative to our debt service, you may recall that we updated our debt policies that includes a review of that should be coming forward with our admin staff and auditor controller as part of the budget process. I think that is a useful benchmark to be sure that we and the public know where we are on that. A couple of just quick questions in your presentation, Mr. Buckshy. Interested to see that in terms of general fund support, you're calling for a 5% reduction for all departments outside of a few. And I guess the question is, are you pretty comfortable, given what we understand about the state budget right now, that we're going to be able to stick within that as opposed to asking for more as we have in times past?
Yeah, that's always the challenge to try to calculate what is the appropriate amount to ask for folks. The approach that we took when we set these targets back in the December time frame was to ask for a little bit more than what we thought we would need based upon the forecasted budget gap in anticipation that we don't know what's going to happen at the state. If things go as as they're stated now at the state budget, we should not have to ask for more. But I would state that if the sales tax extensions at the state level are not passed, and the state does have to double the amount of expenditure cuts from $12.5 billion to $25 billion, while we don't know what that means specifically, I would guess we would be asking for more at that point.
Okay. And then in terms of the positions that might be proposed for elimination, the first thing I saw was that the status quo budget was going to suggest the need to eliminate 8.5 just in and of itself. But the budget augmentation requests came up at plus 8.5. Is that coincidence or is that related?
That's pure coincidence.
Okay. So you say. No. No. Okay. Appreciate that. And then the last question, a total of 65 positions at this point possibly. Do you have a read on roughly how many are vacant at this point due to the chill?
Yeah. Currently about half are vacant, half are filled.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Seebach, I see, has an answer for us.
Update on the question about our debt levels. It's actually closer to 3.5%, and the target in the budget performance measure is to keep it below 5. I think the real danger is to do what the state has done several times, which is roll one problem from this year into the next year with using debt for short-term purposes. We have never done that, thank goodness. Hope we never have to. Some of the other counties have had to have massive cash flow financings, millions and millions every year, just to pay their bills, and we don't need to do that. So we're proud of that and working closely with the administrative office to keep that direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Seebach. And before we get to part two of Mr. Buckshy's presentation, I just wanted to say that it is a great tribute to our organization, I think, from our admin office, all of our departments, our bargaining units, and from the board's policies that we've been able to, each year now, going into the fourth year, make some very painful, significant cuts without having to lay people off, which has been, I think, an enormous achievement, considering that people laid off in our community, our neighbors and friends and parents and such. And so to be able to achieve that, I think, is something quite extraordinary. I also think that we've pushed out on the lead of some of the compensation reforms, not just in our county certainly, but throughout the state, and the bargaining units as well, working with our labor team, recognizing the need to get to I guess what we're all calling the new normal, has been very helpful so that we can get to a point in the future where things will be different, but things will be more sustainable. And I think that that's a great tribute to everybody involved. And we've been able to do it, for the most part, without too much public friction, which is always good. So with that, why don't we get to part two before we want to go fast because we want to take a break before we get to our women's jail project discussion, which many people are waiting for. So, Mr. Buckshy. And then public comment as well.
Okay. So longer-term revenue options, which put a little more directly, would be called tax increases. So again, it was about 3 years ago to this exact date at a strategic planning session that this item was last discussed. Since that time, we have three new board members. It has been 3 years, so we thought we would bring it up for discussion, and we'll go from there. Cover some basic fundamentals. General purpose tax requires a simple majority. A specific purpose tax requires 2/3 majority. I think it would be staff's recommendation, if you were to pursue a tax, that you pursue a general purpose for two reasons. One, it has a greater likelihood of success, obviously. And two, it gives your board more latitude in how to spend that funding as opposed to being locked down into something specific. Timing. There is an 88-day statutory minimum. I would note that if we did stick with the 88 days, our clerk recorder would probably be pulling her hair out, and a good chance she'd be chasing us down, pulling our hair out as well. So probably want to give her a little more lead time than the statutory minimum. Some information in checking around with other cities and counties, as well as a consultant that deals with taxes, is that the norm is to initiate the process about a year and a half to 2 years in advance. And the reason for that is to compile the information, get the word out, and to really inform the citizens of the different options of what happens if the taxes aren't passed and what happens if they would be passed. And it takes a while for folks to warm up to that sort of thing. And, one of the lessons learned from many is that if they do it in too short of a time frame to try to rush it, it hasn't been successful. And that is what one of the things that will make the June ballot initiative for the state interesting. Obviously, that's on very short order. Now, it's been discussed for a while, and the state's budget issues have been widely shared for quite some time, but we'll see how that plays out because that is a very short period of time, and they will be pushing that 88-day threshold. It's somewhere between March 7th and 11th that they're looking at in order to get it on in June. So, that being said, a few of the different options. This goes back to primarily from the staff report data that the auditor's office had pulled together 3 years ago. Generally holds true still. We could, if your board was interested, track down more detailed information depending upon your sentiment. But sales and use tax, if it were increased at a half cent, would be about $20 to $25 million countywide. One of the oddities, I believe, of the legislation is that counties cannot implement this for just the unincorporated area. It has to be countywide, including the cities. I believe it's on our legislative platform, actually, to try to change that, but we've not had any success. That being said, the cities undoubtedly would want their proportional share, and discussions would have to be had about how that would play out. If we stuck with how things are divvied up currently, I believe for the county this would be in the $5 million range, give or take, per year for just the unincorporated area. An important point, as I believe your board knows since you sit on the SLOCOG board, is that in January, SLOCOG staff was directed to conduct a public opinion survey about potential voter sentiment to various taxing options. Now, they would be related to transportation for SLOCOG, but that would be a good indicator. That could be good data to get a gauge of where the public's at, and that could help shape what we may want to do at the county as well. What may make sense at this point is let SLOCOG take the lead on this, conduct the public opinion study, and then go from there. A couple other options. The next two are considerably smaller, not that any revenue wouldn't help, but not nearly the impact that sales or utility users tax would have. Transient occupancy tax, the hotel tax. It says when you go to a hotel, you pay $100, you think it's a $100 room, you check out, it's $130, and you wonder what happened. Well, it's sales tax, and it's a transient occupancy tax. That here, we charge a 9% transient occupancy tax. The cities, all of the cities in the area charge a 10%. Some of their areas have stayed considerably more. I believe San Francisco, it's well over 15, 17, 18%, something like that. Now, I will note that while ours is at 9, we do also have the Business Improvement District, which is an additional 2% levy, and that's the case for most of the other cities as well. That 2% is dedicated towards tourism and marketing efforts, but one of the thoughts is that if we increase by 1%, we'd be in alignment with the cities and where they're at, but again, about $600,000 to $700,000. Business license tax would be a percent of gross sales. This 0.05% was based upon what the city of San Luis Obispo charges, and we believe this could generate about $750,000. This is administratively more difficult. There's more involved in overseeing this and managing it. May take one or two staff, which would obviously reduce the amount of proceeds that would be available. And then last is a utility users tax, which could be taxed on electricity, gas, and phone services in the unincorporated area. It would essentially be an add-on to the utility bills. This is significant at a 5%, which again I believe is what the city of San Luis Obispo charges its residents, would equate to about $7 million for the unincorporated area. So the big levers are sales tax and the utility users tax in terms of potential options. And that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Buckshy. I think we have some questions from the board. I see my colleagues writing. I'm assuming
we'll go to public comment first.
Okay. We could do that unless Mr. Seebach wants to weigh in. I know he is a
I'm a member of the public. Come on.
Okay.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I know this is Jerry Seebach, Auditor Controller Government. I know some of you believe I'm always being bringing bad news or the Grim Reaper. I've been called by Supervisor Meacham, I think. But it just occurred to me there is good news about debt. The other day, we paid off the last payment on a certificate of participation, a bond type issue. It was issued during my term, as early term as auditor. We sold these to build primarily to build the social services building down there on Higuera and Prado Road. And it was just paid off. It was a 20-year deal. And that, I had a very happy phone call from Lee Collins the other day about it. $700,000+ of debt that they don't have to pay anymore. So that's helping their budget. Definitely, and that's once in a while you see something good happening. So we didn't refinance it. We didn't push it out into the future. We didn't sell it like the governor wanted to sell buildings and buy
former
them
governor.
Back. And the former governor, right? So anyway, that is some good news. I thought you might appreciate that.
We do. Thank you.
Well, perhaps we can make it a weekly feature. Jerry Seebach, good news about debt.
Good news corner.
I think if he has weekly good news about debt, I think it would be to all of the citizens' benefit to hear such.
I just hope Supervisor Meacham was listening.
I hope so. I bet you this good news about debt has made him feel all that much better.
Much better.
So let me go to the members of the public before we bring it back to the board. I have a request from Mike Brown, followed by Eric Greening.
Morning again, Supervisor. Mike Brown for CoLab. We would oppose consideration of any new taxes or tax increases. It would be very counterproductive in this environment. And I think, you know, your staff did show that you pushed out the pain new normal concept a couple of years. You may be pushing it out further as well. So appreciate that slide. But these would be very destructive on the economy. You know, it's interesting, there was quite a bit of discussion here about preventing layoffs, but out there in the private sector, in construction and real estate, in facilitation, in all sorts of venues. There have been lots of layoffs, and you're reading in the paper about increasing bankruptcies in the county and increasing foreclosures on homes and so forth. So it's sort of strange that government would think it's exempt from layoffs. Secondly, you know, the presentation was kind of process oriented. You know, we're going to do business as usual and try to reduce services and costs in proportion to some algorithm in the big policy attachment. But you might step outside of the services and the normal budget process and the issue of taxes and fees and say, what could we do? What would be the overarching policy to try to stimulate the economy in the teeth of all these problems that our citizens and businesses are suffering out there? So what if you adopted a policy that said, you know, we want to stimulate the economy. We want more activities out in the agriculture. We want to increase markets. We want to cut permitting time. What if we gave a goal to the departments that said in 1 year we're going to cut permitting time in half for a certain class of permits, and then the year after that we're going to cut it in half again? What if we did things to stimulate markets? You heard from the Economic Development Group that certainty, velocity, and consistency were really important. What if that were a policy that were placed on the entire organization, that we're going to try to help in this context of the new normal and maximize economic activity and, to the extent possible, get things going, and that would be a major policy purpose of this government. So you might want to take a look at that and see what you could do here. Thank you very much.
Mr. Greening, and actually, go ahead, Mr. Greening.
Thank you.
And then followed by Dr. Height.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I would start by reminding us we have not heard all the presentations, understanding that there is some new news on the state budget, and that will be integral to the process here. It sounds as if we are building our budget on the assumption that the revenues will be extended, and that depends on two things. It depends on the legislature putting it on the ballot for June, and it depends on the voters approving the extension. If it's put on the ballot, I understand it's trying to make the normal June primary date with a lot of hair pulling involved, which means that the news from the voters would come in between the publication of the proposed budget and your action on it. And if what the voters do changes all our assumptions about what the revenues will be, how do we react in midstream? So when, and I hope we have it, we get the rest of the presentation, I hope some of these timeline issues about how and when we need to incorporate what assumptions that we're dealing with reality here as we move forward. Relative to revenue options, I welcome the SLOCOG survey process. I would strongly advocate that if something is asked for, it be what is subsequently on the ballot. And if something is characterized, what happens be what's characterized. And it's unfortunate that we're penalized from putting together a specific plan for how we're going to spend the money. To do that requires a two-thirds vote. To just be loosey-goosey, you can get a 50% vote. And I think it should be the other way around. But in any event, Prop 1B was sold on the basis of the roads are falling apart, we need to take care of them. And yet, huge amounts of that money, which has to be repaid with interest and is taking $1.3 billion out of every budget to do it for decades, is a lot of it is going for new roads, not for taking care of the roads. And we need to avoid that kind of deception on our own local level. The state has gotten used to deception, but we locals, and I hope it's trying to get out of that now. It sounds like we've got a governor who says, let's face the facts. But I hope we don't get into that on the local level. of all the tax potentials there, the one that would seem, the only one I think is justifiable in this economy and at this time, but should be explored, is the utility user's tax, especially if frugality in utility use, frugality in energy use, were built into our climate action plan. It could have the double impact of encouraging that frugality while providing substantial revenue if we fail to achieve it. So if there's any tax revenue we should look at, that's probably the first
thank
one
you,
to look
Greening.
At.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Dr. Height, followed by Kim Daniels.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos World Community Workshop, A3 budget updates. For the record, the new social services building is not ADA compliant. There is no pedestrian entrance. These concerns are not petty. Meet legal mandates. Quote, meet legal mandates. You cannot choose to be ignorant of the law. You must meet all legal mandates. Dr. King's dream of equity and social justice became your responsibility for these reasons. You accept state and federal funds conditionally. Conditionally. The term for the receipt of these funds is the assurance that neither the county, cities, contractors, nor subcontractors discriminate. You cannot guarantee those funds will be spent equitably if you do not show good faith and require your budget advisors, your council, your administrator, to educate themselves on the ever-changing laws that are in place to protect 20% of the population, the disabled. No one should be so uneducated as to recommend to the board budget cuts and services that would lead to the institutionalization of your most vulnerable citizens. This would be a violation of the Olmstead Act, U.S. Supreme Court decision. I have given you the opportunity to set the example for the many providers who won't be sure where to cut their budgets based on what you are capable of giving. Civil rights failures are systemic. The attitude of disrespect begins at the top and it filters down. The context of my concern is Los Osos, of course it is. You have a demographic of senior disabled in Los Osos, and you know this because you sit on other boards, like the Transportation Board, that states this in their documents. The board, this board itself has presented a bias against the people of Los Osos based on arbitrary characteristics. We are defamed. If you remain apathetic, if you remain belligerent, to show good faith in this matter and show the state and the federal government and all your providers that you believe in equity, be prepared to give the money back because you must guarantee the funds. You must guarantee that you don't discriminate. Thank you.
Kim Daniels, and that will close public comment on this item.
Good morning, Chairman Hill, members of the board. With all due respect to Mr. Brown and CoLab, I want to make it clear that it isn't that the county has not lost positions. A year ago, 2 years ago, I would have been standing here telling you, as general manager of the largest employee organization, we represent approximately 1,800 members. Today, it's 1,600 members. Those 200 members who have that we no longer represent, have retired and not been replaced. The workload has not diminished. It's just less people doing more work. In addition, our organization, on behalf of the members, has deferred salary increases, frozen benefits, and a number of other things to prevent further layoffs. So it isn't that the county hasn't suffered, and I can't speak for the numbers for the other employee organizations or for managers who are doing double duty now to save money. So we have suffered. We have taken the hits. We just haven't had to do direct layoffs. And I wanted to make sure that that was clear to the listening public. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Daniels. And I would like to follow up, too. Perhaps Mr. Brown is not able to hear us, but we've already corrected him before. Our member supervisor, Meacham, is correcting him on the fact that the county has endeavored now for 2 years, co-chaired by Supervisor Meacham, myself, supported by the full board, and in fact now involving more members. You're not invited to go up to the lectern, Mr. Brown, on economic development efforts for the first time to develop an economic development strategy throughout the county, and I'm quite willing to match this county's financial management with the management that you provided Santa Barbara, sir. Bring it back. to the board. Any questions or comments, Mr. Gibson?
Let me just offer a couple general comments on this topic, which is, of course, a sensitive one. You know, we've tracked for many years the trend that Ms. Daniels referred to is fewer people doing at least as much, if not more, work. And we have wondered at what point the ability of this local government to provide the services that its residents want is going to be seriously compromised. Every year we go through further reductions in the workforce here, and the needs in the community are absolutely not diminishing. So I think we have to face very squarely and with courage and thoughtfulness the question of whether local services should require more revenue. And how much, how it should be gathered, essentially who should pay. I think that's a conversation that we need to get ready for. You know, we're already sort of laying some groundwork, the legislative platform that was referenced. I think we do have to look into whether we can act independently of the cities, as we are with transient occupancy tax. We are also with sales tax. We are below our incorporated cities in those levels, and I think we have to have the conversation to decide what we want to do about that. I would point out that local revenue-raising issues are more successful than people might expect, and CSAC tracks this. We can get that information in front of us. But in the last election cycle, I do recall that more local initiatives to raise revenue in one sort or another passed than failed. And I think that's something that we need to keep as perspective when we wrestle with this particular question. The final comment that I might offer here is that, you know, the realignment being discussed in Sacramento and in every administrative office in the 58 counties right now promises profound change. It's complex beyond reason, perhaps, but it is the nature of our government. With the likelihood that local jurisdictions are going to receive more responsibilities to do things, there will come some amount of funding from Sacramento, but at the same time, we are going to be confronted with local responsibility to determine local levels of services and quite possibly the need to decide on local levels of revenue. So I just, you know, again, staff has indicated this is not a board direction item, but I just wanted to get that out so people can start thinking about it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And I would add to that as well. We have made some rather difficult decisions. We continue to do so with our staff. I do think that we need to, you know, at some point we're going to need to find our way out of this dark forest of nonsense that people sort of have bought into, that we can have everything we want and not pay for it. It's just, you know, this is you know, you don't get to sort of say, well, I want this service, but I don't want to pay for it, or I don't want that service, and I don't want to pay for that, or this nonsense that somehow, you know, basically doing nothing is a way to actually stimulate the economy, which is not something that this county has believes in either. I know, talking to some of the people in the hotel industry, that they would like the county to look at the TOT. I expect to hear more from that probably at a future time. All of the potential revenue enhancements are ones that have to come before voters. So even though I know that anything that seems like a tax is death flavored these days, at some point, you know, people are going to have throughout the state and at every county, hopefully, a candid discussion of what it is that we can do, what it is you want, and what it is you're willing to pay for, because that's where we're at. I mean, you know, it's clear that there's not there's not a lot of extra money to be found somewhere else. So, Supervisor Patterson, and then Mr. Grant.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Cam for coming in and speaking to the issues relative to services provided by public service workers in the county of San Luis Obispo, not only SLOCIA, but all county employees who have taken a hit over the course of the last 3 years, and now we're entering a fourth year where we have substantially reduced, and if Mr. Buckshy's forecast holds true, we will have reduced our staffing by approximately 11% over the last 4 years, including next year, and the work hasn't gone away. I want to also remind the public that we have an aging infrastructure. Each year it gets older, and we need to continue to maintain that as well as provide new facilities for a growing population. And so somehow we have to balance the revenue with the infrastructure, with the services that the public expects. Chairman Hill pointed out, we don't raise revenue without the approval of the public. It's our responsibility to give them that opportunity, but they have the final say. And I know you're not asking for direction, but I think, as Mr. Greening pointed out, that the utility users tax might be something in the future, certainly not now, but in the future we look at. And I would be curious to know how other cities and counties on the Central Coast utilize that revenue source. I would like to know that. And also, I'll point out that 5 of the 7 incorporated cities over the past few years have adopted a sales tax enhancement for their communities, and that's something that they've done. Their residents have wanted that to provide better services, and it should be something that we consider as the Council of Governments is doing currently, and I do support that effort. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Grant?
Thank you. I just want to point out that, yes, your board's correct that over the years we've made a lot of reductions in the budget and a significant reduction in staff, but we have done a lot with less at this point in time. And this budget that we have before us now that we're working through with departments really does show some significant service level decreases that your board's going to have to make some fairly significant choices in terms of what levels of services to provide. So we are there. We're at the bottom. I think staff has done everything they can to hold everything together and provide as many services as we could to keep it going. But I think we've reached that point where there's going to have to be some choices made.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Mr. Buckshy. We will take a 15-minute break, come back at about 11:15 with the Women's Jail Project. Okay, thank you, Madam Clerk. We're going to come back, and we shall get to our next item, which I know many people are here for because I see uniforms. And that would be
familiar faces.
That's right. So who is going to – I see –
I'll go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Grant, do you want to kick it off then?
Thank you. This next item is an update and a status report for the new women's jail and jail medical facility. We've been working in a team effort over the last number of months after we reported to your board the first time, and we've done a lot of work in preparing this report for you, and Vince Morici from the Administrative Office and Chief Deputy Reed will be starting this presentation off, and we have a number of other speakers that will join in as we move through the presentation. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Morici.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Vince Morici with the County Administrative Office. We're back before your board with a women's jail project. I thought I'd do a very brief recap of what that project is to start with for our listening audience. The Women's Jail Project consists of three main components. The first component is a women's housing unit, which with an approximate capacity of 196 beds. The second component will be a new medical and program facility, which will be available to all the inmates at the jail. It's not gender specific. And the last component is a new security system for the entire jail, which will be needed regardless of whether the first two components move forward. The three components are estimated to cost about $36.4 million. Oh, yeah, you want to do that? Thank you. And the state has conditionally awarded us about $25.1 million. There's a fourth component, which is the expansion of the intake release area. It's an optional project. It's not really considered as part of this project at this time as well, but that would add an additional $5.5 million. Although the county was conditionally awarded money from the state, back in 2008, we were still not clear of what strings would be attached with that funding. And so that and the continuing worsening of the state finances led us to conclude that we should probably put the project on hold. The project was placed on hold in December, and it's remained there since. In mid-2010, the state provided clarification regarding what would be necessary to be eligible for the project. And that's when staff brought the project back to your board as part of the September 21st meeting. We brought it back to your board. We presented three options. One, move forward with the project. Two, keep the project on hold. Or three, terminate the project. And your board had several questions on a number of different topics and elected to keep the project on hold and direct staff to work with the key criminal justice agencies and the health agency and then return back to your board, which this is the topic of today's meeting. The four topics that you had some questions about included how much space was available in the current design of the women's jail for programming, whether that's counseling services and other services designed to reduce recidivism, what kind of current programs existed for recidivism reduction, what is being done to coordinate the future program efforts among the criminal justice agencies as well as other organizations, and what kind of potential programs might we run in the future. As part of this presentation today, we have with us members of the working group that we put together, which includes Sheriff Ian Parkinson, Chief Deputy Probation Officer Jim Salio, Karen Baylor, the Behavioral Health Administrator, Susan Matherly, the Superior Court Administrator, Gerald Shea, District Attorney. We also have Lieutenant Michelle Cole, who's a correctional lieutenant at the jail, who will be speaking on this matter as well. And to start us off, the first topic we're going to address will be space for programming, and Chief Deputy Rob Reed will walk us through this topic.
Chief Deputy, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the board. Thank you, Vince. As a recap of why we began this project, is it going to work? Yeah. Yeah, up here. Okay, we need to get to the next slide somehow. Let's see. Anyway, why we began this project, the women's jail is currently rated at 43. However, it's severely overcrowded with a daily population average of 80, and it has been as high as 110. This creates problems not only for the inmates, but the staff who must deal with the multitude of issues that arise when people are forced to live in crowded conditions. The project, if approved, will provide adequate beds for housing the current population and ample space to provide programming that will help reduce recidivism. As we continue to see inmate populations grow, the added space will help us be ready for future needs. One future need we are still uncertain about is the state's proposal for realignment and how that could increase our populations dramatically in the very near future, even before this project could be completed. But let's look at the proposed project itself. The proposed design of the project is for a housing unit with approximately 38,000 square feet that provides for 196 total beds if double bunked in all areas and 7,400 square feet for the medical, mental health, and program building. The basic question asked at the September 21st board meeting is whether the new women's jail and medical facility have sufficient programming capability.
This is an overall view of the project area. The slide is very busy, and I'll discuss each part of the project briefly. The AB 900 project has two components. First is the women's housing unit. There's going to be a lot of clicks in here. This is a two-tiered building where the actual beds are provided. Next is the medical, mental health, and programs building. And third component is the property and security electronics portion of the project, which is necessary to support this project and the balance of the jail. And that's that small portion. We move on to the next slide, please. This slide shows the design of the women's housing unit, a two-tiered building with housing on both floors. The colored area are the cells, both individual and groups, and house from 1 to 8 inmates each. The green areas show space for programming that is within the actual housing units and enable teachers or counselors to work with inmates comfortably in the housing units rather than using custody staff to move the inmates to classrooms elsewhere in the jail. The blue areas are the main day rooms for use when there are programs that can benefit the entire housing unit. The pink areas are rooms where individual one-on-one counseling or interviews can take place, still within the housing unit, which reduces the number of correctional staff required to move inmates. The boxed areas at the top and bottom of the screen are large rooms for up to 12 inmates and can be utilized both for male and female inmates. We look back at the overall, and then the next slide shows the second tier floor above. Again, the green areas will show the programming within the housing units of the cells. As we move to the medical mental health programming building, which to keep for short I'll refer to as the medical building, again, a very busy slide from the schematic design. Three mental health treatment and evaluation rooms are designed to provide services to all jail inmates. Next are the medical areas, which provide two exam rooms for efficient use of staff time. A dental suite is included that will enable in-house dental services rather than transporting inmates out of the jail to a local dentist office for treatment. The largest portion of the medical area contains medical and mental health staff offices, medical record storage, and a secure pharmacy. This portion of the building is a secure area for staff only and no inmate use. The blue areas are for the programming spaces in this building. There is one classroom for up to 6 inmates and others for up to 12. One benefit to these rooms is having an attached restroom for inmates to use during their training classes. This eliminates the requirement to have a correctional deputy escort the inmate to another part of the jail in the middle of a class. The boxed areas are office space. One is for the person assigned to coordinate all the jail programs. The other is for one-on-one programming or counseling as necessary. As a recap, the program space that we have here, the women's jail housing unit is approximately 38,000 square feet. Maximum capacity is 196 beds when double bunked. The new women's jail will have approximately 1,400 square feet available for programs. That includes 16 day use, 2 classrooms, 6 interview rooms. 14,000, not 1,400. The new medical facility will have approximately 1,800 square feet, which includes 4 group classrooms, 3 mental health treatment rooms, and 2 offices. Total for the entire complex is about 16,000 square feet, and this is for the new construction. Compare this to the existing jail complex today has about 9,000 square feet available for all inmates. So to answer the question as to whether design includes space for current and future programs is yes. With that, I'll turn it back over to Vince.
Thank you. We're going to take a look at some of the current programs, and to help us do that, we have Chief Deputy Probation Officer Jim Salio, and Karen Baylor will also assist in the later part of this presentation.
Mr. Salio.
Good morning, Board members. Jim Salio, Chief Probation Officer. The board asked us to look at, to come back and report on what programs we have within the criminal justice system that addresses issues of substance abuse and mental illness. Two of the programs that we have that address issues of substance abuse are Proposition 36, which is a court-mandated sentencing alternative to incarceration for those offenders convicted of certain drug offenses. In our county, Prop 36 works as a collaborative team between the court, probation, and county drug and alcohol services to provide treatment for offenders who fall into this category. A more high-level supervision program we consider it the next step up from Prop 36 is our county drug court. Again, drug court is a treatment court, combined collaboration between the court, drug and alcohol services, and probation. The offenders placed into drug court a lot of times have gone through lower level programs, and this we consider to be our highest level of treatment in the county for the criminal justice system. It should be noted that both of these programs do rely on the jail heavily as short-term sanctions for violations in these programs. Nearly half of the population in Prop 36, sometime during their supervision, will spend some time in the county jail. In drug court, nearly three-quarters of the people that have gone through the drug court program under supervision will have spent some time in county jail. And again, we call this usually flash incarceration. It's for a short period of time, helps the person get stable, refocused, and then we get them back out into treatment. Next, Dr. Karen Baylor will talk about the programs we have in the criminal justice system for mentally ill offenders.
Dr. Baylor, thank you.
Good morning. Karen Baylor, Behavioral Health Administrator. In the spirit of good news, as you saw with the Prop 36, it's an unfunded mandate. The Drug and Alcohol Department just found out last week that it's going to receive a grant from the CalEMA, which is California Emergency Management, to deal with felons for a year. So they should be serving 65 clients, at least for the felons. So we're very thrilled to be able to keep that program going. I'm here to talk about just real briefly two MHSA programs, which is Mental Health Services Act. A couple years ago, several of us got together and decided that one of our existing programs wasn't as effective as it could be, and so we pulled together the DA, the judge, the public defender, probation, sheriff, members of the mental health board, and we retooled it. We looked at some evidence-based practices. We looked at the federal regs and developed a behavioral health treatment court. This is very small caseloads, and we're able to fund a probation officer with this. So you've got a very small team of folks with a probation officer who works with this clientele. These are the severe mentally ill post-plea, and we've developed this program so that there's levels of intensity through the program and with the hope to graduate folks within a year to 18 months out of the program. And out of the 29 people that we served, only one was sent back to jail. The Forensic Reentry Service is a brand new program, only a year old, and this was because of our stakeholder process and the Mental Health Board, and they really wanted to see services for the jail inmates. And you know, with Mental Health Services Act, it can't be used for involuntary treatment. So what this program does is does a reach in into the jail with those who I call discharge. I think it's release. About to be released, yeah. So they're about to be released, and they're identified either through custody staff or through our mental health staff, and they provide lots of services for those folks. They'll even come pick them up when they get released from the jail, get them housing, get them to their first appointment, get them connected. And we're very proud of this. Out of the 75 folks we served that first year, only three were sent back to jail. So that's pretty impressive. And then the last program is what we currently have in our jail in the jail program. We currently have three staff, and you can see the services that they provide. They do a lot of triaging and medication management and trying to work with the custody staff on keeping things calm in the jail. We, on average, see about 400 people a month, but we get requests. It usually averages over 600 requests every month for services, and so they triage who they need to see and then provide those services. So they're very brief, they're very short-term, and try to help things stabilize, and then hopefully they'll be able to get into our reentry program once they're released. And with that, Vince?
The next slide deals with sheriff department programs that take place within the jail. These are largely sponsored by or run by the sheriff department, and Lieutenant Michelle Cole will speak to these.
Lieutenant?
Good morning, board members. Michelle Cole, correctional lieutenant, county jail. The programs currently provided at the jail include academic, vocational, and life skills training classes. The general education classes, the GED classes, provide an opportunity for the inmates to take the GED exam and also obtain their GED certificate. Approximately 250 inmates per year go through this program. The general education and English as a second language classes teach inmates basic reading and writing skills, and approximately 10 to 14 inmates go through this program per month. Computer skills and the life skills classes are provided to the female inmates. The computer classes teach clerical and computer skills, along with job interview techniques. The life skills classes provide instruction on basic personal finance, relationship skills, and how to cope with stress. Approximately 12 to 14 female inmates participate a month in these classes. The workplace readiness class is a workshop-type class offered to the male honor farm inmates currently. The inmates are provided information on local jobs, taught job search skills, and provided instruction on how to write resumes and cover letters. They're also taught interview techniques. And approximately 40 to 60 inmates take advantage of this class. Along with the educational classes, the jail also provides limited opportunities to learn vocational skills through work detail programs. These include landscape maintenance and culinary classes or culinary skills. Additionally, community-based organizations volunteer their services and provide programs in the jail, such as Alcoholics and Narcotics Anonymous, and faith-based organizations provide services in counseling.
Thank you, Michelle. This moves us to our next topic, which deals with the collaboration of the criminal justice partners, and you're starting to see that there are a number of them here today, and we've all been working together. And with that, I'll introduce Senator Susan Matherly, the Superior Court Administrator.
Hi, I'm Susan Matherly, the Court Executive Officer for the Superior Court, and I'm here on behalf of the judges because they would like me to express their enthusiastic support of the Women's Jail Project. They would also like me to suggest that the Countywide Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee be charged with recommending, monitoring, and evaluating current and proposed jail programs aimed at reducing recidivism. The Countywide Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee, or CCJCC as we call it, is a body consisting of judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, probation, mental health, police, and sheriff representatives. The CCJCC is an advisory body established by the court to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of the local criminal justice system. And the purpose is to strengthen interagency coordination, communication, and cooperation. We meet quarterly, and we have appointed in the past several subcommittees to investigate discrete issues of concern to its members. Again, on behalf of the judges, we would like you to support restarting the Women's Jail Project, and we thank you very much for this opportunity to express our support of this very important public safety project. I'm sorry, I'm having allergies today, so it's hard to talk.
Thank you, Ms. Matherly.
Okay, now we move on to the last topic, which are the potential programs to reduce recidivism. We're going to start this with Jim Salio again. Then Sheriff Ian Parkinson will speak to the projects dealing with in-custody vocational programs, and he'll do the conclusion and the recommendation as well. Oh, excuse me. I left out somebody. District Attorney Jerry Shea wanted to come up and speak on the collaboration piece. I'm sorry, Jerry.
It's okay. I'm sitting back there, and you probably couldn't see me. Good morning. Jerry Shea, District Attorney. Good to see you all this morning. I just had a couple of comments, if I may just take a few moments of your time. One is that I wanted to echo what Ms. Matherly said about the CCJCC. It's going to be a great forum to talk about some of these issues, for all of us to collaborate and to work with the courts in terms of trying to create some solutions for recidivism in our county. The other thing I wanted to mention to you is that the departments that are before you today, and there are about five of them, the health agency, the courts, the probation, the sheriff's office, and our office, have worked and have a history of working collaboratively on recidivism for a number of years. And I'm just thinking of one particular project that I'll mention to you right now. It's the Anti-Gang Coordinating Commission, which we created about 2.5 years ago. The sheriff, the probation chief, and our office created. It has a strategic plan, and one major dimension of that strategic plan is rehab and rehabilitation and reentry for parolees and probationers coming out of county jail. As some of you who have attended some of those meetings know, that AGCC meeting is attended by a variety of different county departments, including, I've written them down, the health department, general services, the courts, the planning department, county office of education, and a number of other departments that collaborate on that AGCC strategic plan. The particular part that I'm talking about right now is the rehab and reentry part of it. We have been developing vocational, educational, drug and mental health therapy and apprenticeship programs along with employment links for those people who are coming out of county jail as probationers. So I just kind of want to reiterate the fact that we as a county have been working collaboratively on this issue for some time, and I think the issue that you're talking about today, the expansion of the county jail, will allow us to work even better and even more fully on this issue of recidivism. So thanks very much for the opportunity to comment. I really appreciate it. Thanks, Vince.
Thank you, Mr. Shea.
Now we'll hear from Jim Salio.
Jim Salio, Chief Probation Officer. We know what works out there in reducing recidivism. The Probation Department has embarked on a strategic plan to introduce evidence-based programs to community corrections in the county. One of such programs that we're moving forward on is Thinking for Change, or T4C. This is an evidence-based program endorsed by the National Institute of Correction. It's cognitive behavioral in nature, designed at trying to reduce criminogenic factors in offenders. The sheriff and I have talked about programs that could come into the jail. T4C would be a very easy program to replicate inside the jail. In that it's short-term in nature and very direct curriculum. So I will turn this over to Vince to introduce the sheriff to talk about his future plans for programming.
Sheriff Ian Parkinson.
Welcome, Sheriff.
Ian Parkinson, Sheriff, in case you don't recognize me. Thank you. For having us today. I'm going to address three real issues: our future vision, funding program possibilities, and also some staffing costs that have come up as questions. First, in the area of future vision, I think over the last 2 years, I've presented on many occasions and some in front of several of you my plan to expose inmates to job skill training, and I think that's very important right now. I think we have some opportunity right now that exists at the jail that we could expand on, and I think it'll do a couple things. First, it'll involve bringing the community together, both community partnerships with business, community partnership with Cuesta, Cal Poly, and hopefully any concerned citizen getting involved and reduce the cost to us. And finally, it's designed to reduce the population. I firmly believe that building more housing is one aspect of it, but also reducing that population at the same time is equally important, and that's what you're hearing today. Regarding funding program possibilities, I think there's an opportunity to expand the home arrest detention program, and currently that's a program that's in place that is designed to be self-funding, and it's very close now. We have recently been in front of you to expand that program with some more anklets, GPS anklets, as you may recall. And I think by expanding that program, it's going to actually generate some more revenue. I would recommend to the board that we take that revenue and actually put it into an account that could be administered by a body to help fund some of these programming or these programs that have been brought up to you today. And finally, I want to mention staffing costs, because I know this has also been a subject that has come up by at least a couple of board members, and that is what down the road here, what is it going to take the cost to staff the new facility? And the original estimate was $1.5 million to staff it. I think realistically this is a difficult area, and I think if we were to open the facility today, it's going to cost about half that, about $750,000. And the reason why is because right now we have a handle on how many inmates we currently have. We run about 80 in custody. Moving to a larger facility, so we can fairly safely estimate that. What we don't know is in 3 years what that population is going to look like, what it's going to grow to, and also as the Chief Reed mentioned, with the prison realignment, what kind of impact is that going to have on us? We're probably looking at a 25% increase, and so we are going to be affected, and that's going to affect the staffing numbers. This is a unique animal in the sense that we don't use male correctional officers in a female jail. We use female-only correctional staff, so we have to train them and have them available and ready to occupy this facility once we get close. Closing, recommendations, conclusion, one of those. The current design, I think, as presented to you today, hopefully answered the questions about, is there space for programming? One of the things that wasn't mentioned that I was listening to was, just the other day I was in the female jail and there was some counseling going on, and the reason I knew it was going on, because it was being conducted in the hallway. There is no facility in the female jail available for counseling unless it's in the yard, which there's only one yard, and it takes away the ability for inmates to be there. Or it's done in the hallway, where obviously there's not a lot of privacy and there's a lot of disturbance. So currently, there is no counseling facility, and I think this design clearly shows that there will be in multiple levels. Current programs are largely on the outside of the jail right now. I think the challenge will be bringing them into the jail, and I think with the partnerships that we have, I think those challenges will be able to be accomplished in the future. And ultimately, as you heard, the County Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, as the DA likes to say, CCJCC, he's pretty good at that, will help evaluate and plan for the future of these programs. Next slide. Recommendation. I want to start out by just saying that it's a good thing when we're talking about a jail project and we're almost at the end is when the sheriff gets up to speak. Because ultimately what these projects are about is all county services. And I think as you've seen today with all the people presenting, this truly is a county project, and it's designed that way. This is not for show. This is a location or a building that's located on the sheriff's property, but it's really a community effort or a group effort in this. And so I thank the presenters, some that worked on this for many years and some that have gotten involved in this portion of the project. So my long-winded closing or recommendation is that the board do not pass on this AB 900 money, this $25 million, and that we cautiously move forward in our next step in this project in opening up a new female jail.
Thank you, Sheriff. Vince, did you want to?
No, that concludes the presentation. We have, we're available for
good. I know we have questions.
I had a relatively easy part today. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Well, that was a good presentation. It was like the ice capades. Or skating in and out. I just saw someone skate out. Okay, let's begin with Supervisor Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Hill. I'll be brief. I did have an extended conversation with Mr. Salio and Sheriff Parkinson last week, and they answered a number of questions, which actually that information was provided to us today in the presentation. And I'm very supportive of the project. I feel good that it's going to provide opportunities to address some of the deficiencies that currently exists, and I'm not talking about lack of bed space. I'm talking about increased programs to help people get their lives back in order so they can be productive members of society. And I'm very appreciative of the efforts of all the departments working together. Even though the CCJCC has been functioning for a while, I think they've received a new lease on life, so to speak, and putting the program together that both Supervisor Hill and Supervisor Gibson requested when this was last before us to ensure that we have programming available, that it isn't just a lock-em-up facility. And I think they've done that, and I appreciate that effort, and am supportive of moving forward and look forward to seeing the county move forward with this project. I know Chief Deputy Reed and I have talked about this for a number of years. I think it's 4 years now that we've had this conversation about moving this project forward, and I hope we can do that.
Mr. Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Hill. Just a couple questions, and I don't know if these are addressed to Chief Deputy Reed or to Vince, but in your presentation it talks about the jail programs. Vocational education skills are taught to the female inmates, but it doesn't say anything about the male. I'm thinking about workforce jobs, putting these guys back out in the workforce, labor union, welders, that kind of stuff. Is that kind of stuff taught, or is it going to be taught, or is there an opportunity for these people to learn something like that?
Chief Deputy Reed, responding to your question, the programs and things that we've displayed today mostly happen within the existing jail. What you're talking about for the males, we do have a huge honor farm complex that has much of this training going on there. We do afford it to them also, but we're focusing today on just showing you what we can do and what we do do with the women currently.
Okay. And the other question on the attachment.
Sure. Excuse me, can I just add something to that?
I apologize.
No, I'm sorry. I just wanted to add, because you specifically mentioned something, as the chief pointed out, we do have a welding shop, we do have a wood shop, we do have a bicycle shop. These are all opportunities that we intend to capitalize on, and when it comes to a vocational skill and helping them, either just exposing them to a trade, and then hopefully when they get out of custody, directing them where they can get further training, either through Cuesta College or some private business, hopefully.
Very good. Thank you. And the next question goes to the attachment 2A, where it shows the layout of the facility. Where the new medical facility is, it says the current location of the existing women's jail. So is that facility going to be remodeled? Is it going to be torn down?
It'll be torn down. It's going to be done in stages. Of course, we'll need the women's jail while we build the new women's jail. Once the new women's jail is complete and operational, then we'll remove the existing structure that is the current women's jail and construct a medical facility.
The new medical site. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm particularly grateful to see such a range of county departments participating in this, and similar to the Anti-Gang Coordinating Commission, it's these are difficult problems with a history of limited success, and I'm hopeful that the collaboration we're seeing here suggests that we're ahead of the curve here, especially as we stare realignment in the face as a possible future. A detailed question. In the medical facility, Chief Deputy Reed, is that programming area available both to the men's side and the women's side of the facility?
Yes, it is. In the medical facility, that's for all inmates in the county jail. Okay. In the women's housing unit, there are two rooms that are available for both men and women.
Okay. So we are, on the whole, increasing programming space overall for all
that is correct.
Incarcerated residents. And the second one actually goes to Ms. Matherly. It might be a little bit on the spot here, but in seeing this collaboration and in working on innovative ways of doing things like home arrest and detention, which I think is a very promising avenue, it sounds like the judges have the discretion within their sentencing guidelines to do some things possibly differently. Am I reading that correctly? Because I know one of the complaints about some corners of our judicial system is that judges are rather shackled, if you'll allow that ironic idea, in terms of how they can sentence convicted individuals.
Well, I've talked to the judges at length about some of these ideas and concepts, and they're really excited. And that's one of the reasons they want to use the CCJCC as a vehicle, because they can't do anything without the DA and the prosecutors and with the public defenders agreeing to some of these things. So having them participate in the decision-making about whether these programs work and helping evaluate programs, I think it helps the judges make better sentencing options. But they do handle most of their decision-making on a case-by-case basis. So they do take recommendations from the probation department. So it's hard for me to answer that with just a blanket that, yes, they're on board with new sentencing options, but they are definitely excited about reducing recidivism.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. I have a couple of questions and also try to weave in some questions from Supervisor Meacham, who is watching from home, but of course, as we know, he's doing his homework. For the sheriff, if I could, and I also want to join in my colleagues' gratitude for hearing us in September. I know you were here, not yet the sheriff, but when the board had sent this back and had said that we want to see more collaboration and a more informative presentation, working with the probation, working with the courts, working with the DA. That's what we got here today, and I want to commend you for that.
Thank you.
Before I ask you questions.
Okay.
So
I thought that was it.
I know, you thought you're getting off easy. So we have basically about an average of 73 female inmates, and that's obviously too many. We don't have enough room for that many. We're looking to build a facility that will allow for 196 beds, so the obvious question is why so many, especially since we do want to focus more on reducing recidivism. We've all seemed to be in agreement that certainly a big part of what we want to do is to stop people from committing crimes and going to jail and returning again. So why so many beds?
Well, I can't discuss or present on the history of it. I can say this, and I'll allow the chief to weigh in on this in just a second. I would like to say that we were aware that the realignment was coming. Mm-hmm. That would be a great answer. Unfortunately, we cannot, but that will affect the number of beds now. Mr. Patterson raised that question to us, why that number, and mm-hmm. our answer at this point was because we don't know what's ahead, and we do have to build in room for growth. We don't want to come back in 10 years and do this project all over again. So I'm going to turn that to Chief Reed and see if he can give you a better answer than I just gave you.
Okay. Thank you. When we began designing this jail, we looked at the geometry of how things work and what type of space we could put a facility in. 196 beds is not what we came up with in our initial designs. But in working with the architect, what we did come up with was some different designs that gave us this many beds. We could reduce that number of beds. It's pretty much going to cost the same. We might take $5,000 or $6,000 out of the budget, reduce our costs because we have so many spaces. One of the things that we're doing in all of our one-person cells is, with the blessing of the state, we're double bunking them, which means in a small space about the size of your average household bathroom, we're putting two people instead of one. That's where the numbers, go up by just the mere factor of the doubling of it. Mm-hmm. Other than that, it would be a lot fewer beds.
Okay. And do we have any sense, I think, Sheriff, you quoted that there could be 25% increase in inmates coming if the state goes through with its plans to release people to, I guess, their original county of arrest. Is that right? Do we have any sense of how many of them would be, or what percentage of that would be female, or...
Well, we're applying a number of about 130, and I'm just applying the same percentage from male to female that we currently have. We have no indication that we're going to be any different from that, but that's the assumption we're making.
Okay. I think that's it for now, and I have a question for the CAO, if I can. And this has to do, and Supervisor Meacham brought this up, I think, with you, and I also have some questions about the impact. Sheriff Parkinson said that he expected the ongoing staffing impact to be less than estimated, at least initially, as much as half So the question that Supervisor Meacham, I have, I think all of us have, is what kind of impact, you know, for our decision here, I think we're all impressed with the need to do something about the current women's jail situation. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Of course, our commitment is $10 million and then the ongoing staffing costs. And so the question is how is that going to impact our general fund, seeing as how we're contracting for the fourth year in a row substantially throughout all of our other departments? I know it's not an easy – it's a big question without an easy answer, but –
It is a big question, and yeah. We don't have an easy answer. What I can say, though, is this is a future project, so we do have the $10 million for construction set aside, so we do have that money available. The construction itself will take 3 years probably before we even open the doors. Mm-hmm. And at that point, certainly we have a budget that's contracting right now. We're having issues, and we're struggling with providing service levels. And it could be an issue 3 to 4 years from now. But I think given the fact that the sheriff has provided maybe a solution that helps the budget situation out from rather than at $1.6 million a year, we can cut that in half for at least a few years. That brings it down into the $800,000 range in that area. We would have to, at that point in time, work that out within the budget. It's going to be a general fund expense. I am hoping that we've seen the bottom of our fiscal calamity, basically, although I don't know that. It could be another year or so, but I think by that time we're going to be growing out of that, and we'll be able to somehow, and I don't know the answer, but be creative and work that staffing level in with the other services that we provide. It may be that the board does have to make some critical decisions in terms of what gets funded and what doesn't. I mean, if the budget situation is no better than it is today, then you'd be faced with some very serious issues to deal with. But so that's the best I can do. I'm thinking it's, again, 3 to 4 years out. We're hoping the budget situation gets better at that point in time, and we will work the dollars into there. I will say that in the past, when we built the men's jail in the early 90s, we were having the same type of budget issues and problems we are having today. Not quite as severe, mm-hmm. but we certainly went through the same discussion. It was, to the board at that time, it was something that we had to do to meet our needs for the future, and ultimately it worked out that we did. We were able to work it into the budget, and I feel fairly confident today that we can do the same thing.
Now, going back to our previous presentation on the budget and some of the things, of course, that we've been involved in some of our compensation reform, would we anticipate that by the time a new women's jail would be up and running and they would have to hire, as was pointed out, you know, we need female correctional officers to work in the jail and such, that that such hires would be under the new system that we've begun to implement, which involves everything from increased pension cost sharing to a second tier to our new rational universe on prevailing wage? Is that a...
I think that's a
It's an assumption, I know.
Assumption
is it a good assumption?
Yes, it's a good assumption that we will take care of that.
Okay.
I would say, just to finalize here, mm-hmm. from my point of view, that you know, given the real fragile nature of our budget right now and the unknown state impacts that are out there, that we should move ahead, but very cautiously move forward mm-hmm. Over the next few months to allow staff to work with the departments and their budgets and understand the state impacts that are coming down. So if we started moving forward just cautiously, working with the state to put the contracts together to secure the $25 million, restart the discussions with our architect, I think that in and of itself will take 2 or 3 months to do. It'll give us a much better idea of where we're going to be within the budget, and if things change radically, we can come back and discuss with the board other options.
Okay, so you would anticipate that we would have some update, even if it's mm-hmm. relatively brief, within 3 or 4 months?
Yes.
Okay. Supervisor Patterson.
Yes, just quickly to recap a couple of things. As both Sheriff Parkinson and Mr. Grant stated, that $1.6 million operating costs is at full capacity, and that's not going to happen overnight. It also won't happen for 2 to 3 years, and hopefully things will turn around, and it'll be an incremental increase in staffing costs. So we'll have the ability to, I think, adjust as we need to. And also one other thing I think is important to point out, and that is the $25 million state grant is for facilities only. We can't use that money for staffing, and so it is available to us to build a new facility, and I do think we ought to take advantage of that. And as was pointed out, it's more than just a women's jail. It's a new medical facility and also a new security system, which is very essential for both the men and women's jail at this point. So I think it's a good deal for us to take advantage of.
Thank you. Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd only first thank the sheriff for taking a very close look at the staffing cost issues. It's the first time I've heard that level of detail, and I appreciate the digging in on that. And the only the thing I'll leave you with here is I would observe that we have to work it out in terms of operating this facility, because this is something that this local government has to do. And realignment will affect us as to what kind of resources we have. But at the bottom line, if you you look at some of the primary functions of government, to deal appropriately with criminal offenders is right there at the top of the list.
Okay. Before we bring it back to the board, let's go to the public. I have two requests to speak, Mike Brown followed by Dr. C. Height.
Board members, Mike Brown representing CoLab. Certainly, as was presented out here, without the sanction of jail, many of the other programs won't work. There needs to be that threat or delivery there so that you can have some accountability in the system. And as been pointed out, this is a core function of a county government that needs to have the priority. That being said, as was pointed out in your budget session earlier, there's about $142 million of true local general fund discretionary revenue available right now. AB 900, I think it's about a 30-year contract that you're going to have to run this jail in accordance with all the mandates and state standards if you accept the $25 million. So one suggestion would be along the lines of staff projections that you do a chart that says the jail opens in 2015 based on what you'd reasonably expect for cost of living increases for the staff, the ramp up of the staff. What would 10 years on a curve look like for that jail? And then you could do two scenarios of that. One, if your union associations agree to a two-tier system and paying half the freight for their retirement, and one if they don't, because that's a two-way street. And then you could juxtapose that against the $142 million or whatever you think that might be beginning in 2015. And that would tell you where the other cuts might have to come when you get to that decision. And everybody would be going in here with their eyes wide open. So would it be in planning and building? Would it be in county council? Would it be in the general fund portions of some other department? It certainly wouldn't make sense to cut the sheriff or probation or the district attorney or the public defender when you're already making this investment in the law and justice system. So just a suggestion. Thank you very much.
Dr. Height.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos Rural Community Workshop. Overcrowded jails are inhumane. It creates a hardship for every guard, every administrator. Imagine their dilemma. The video documentation of the women's jail puts one of the richest counties in America according to the County Community Foundation, in par with third world countries. It is shameful. Years ago, the grand jury commented on the overcrowding in the women's jails, women sleeping on the floors. How will you accommodate? The issue is accommodation. Does anyone know how many of these women have limitation in one or more daily life activity? How many are crowded into jails and returned to jails because of service failures? I have spoken to you about the Olmstead Act. Community-based services are in place to withhold these services to provide ineffective or substandard services because you lack the facility presents a false statement of worth. Jail is a form of institutionalization, and withholding services and the lack of services leads to chronic institutionalization. Supportive services for women and their families on the outside is essential to preventing women from returning to jail, being hospitalized, placed in asylums, mental health group homes, even old folks' homes. These are all forms of institutionalization. The county has a huge tax base, according to the Community Foundation. And yet the county has a reputation for not providing services, and I'm referring to your scandal in social services. The county has a huge tax base. You have a new social services, a huge building here for your facility. SLOCOG has remodeled facilities. RTA has new facilities, and yet your women are sleeping on the floors. You have a huge tax base, and yet you deny the dead a decent burial, discarding the homeless in the ocean off Morro Bay. The overcrowded conditions in the women's jail is indecent. It's like a bad B movie. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height. Closing it to public comment, bring it back to the board, and I wanted to make a few comments before I go to my colleagues. I'm certainly a lot more comfortable with this presentation, with this project, than I was in September, and I thank everybody who's worked hard on bringing us information and working together and showing the kind of collaboration we need across all of our departments and the courts. So I really think that was very helpful. I also think that we're going to need a new woman's jail. You know, that's clear, and we have state money now that is unlikely to be there at some other point. And, you know, I think that we've seen a lot of problems in the country that have come from putting things off that you then have to pay a lot more for. I think Supervisor Patterson mentioned infrastructure in an earlier discussion. That's a good example. You know, there are certain just fundamental services and things that we provide as a government that we have to pay for, and I think it's part of our job, working with our agency heads to make sure that the money is well spent, that we have had our concerns addressed, and I feel satisfied on that point. But it does seem to me that if we're going to have to build a woman's jail, maybe at the point of a court order in 5 or 6 years, when we don't have $25 million matching from the state, then we're going to be kicking ourselves for not doing it when we should have done it. So I am much more comfortable. I understand this is a difficult decision to make in a time when we're really reducing services that we have to offer in the county, where we're having to continue to downsize our workforce. It's difficult to then, but that's part of what we do. We have to prioritize. We have to make sure that certain functions are met no matter what. And that's why I feel more comfortable about moving this forward, restarting it. And I feel that it also offers an opportunity that perhaps we haven't seen enough of good collaboration between our various law enforcement partners. that we may not have seen enough of in the past. This provides, you know, to hear Ms. Matherly talk about the judges being very, I know that they are very interested in doing whatever can be done to reduce recidivism and to partner with the sheriff and the DA and the probation officer. I mean, this is a really important opportunity, and we will, I know, no matter what happens, be wanting to see the results of that. I'm glad that there is the CCJCC, if that's the right initials, that will be evaluating and monitoring, and I think that this board's going to want to get reports on that eventually down the line, because I think that this is a big decision that we have to make about how to spend county money, and we want to make sure that everything's being done as best as it can be. So that's my comments. I feel like things have gone in the right direction. Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That sums very much my opinion of progress since we heard this in September. I, too, feel much more comfortable and am greatly heartened by what I perceive to be a blossoming of enthusiasm for progressive, for adaptive programs that are going to take a wider view of our criminal incarceration and, more importantly, rehabilitation programs. It occurs to me that, you know, we in local government have to adapt to the future. And we cannot, I think, with good conscience, look the other way to the funding opportunity that's before us on the table. And yet, in adapting to the unknown future, there's inherent risk. We don't know exactly how it's going to be. So I think we have a balanced approach here. It occurs to me that even in the time that I've been on the board and we've been discussing the women's jail, the facility of itself has morphed from being sort of an end in itself, i.e. a lockup, as the term was used before, to a facility which provides a solution, or at least is working very hard to provide a solution to one of the most difficult problems that we face in society. So based on what I've heard here, and with the understanding that this board continues its interest in the programming side of criminal rehabilitation issues, I'm certainly comfortable moving forward in the manner that our CAO has outlined, being sure that we are mindful of the current ongoing crisis of the state, but it looks to me like we have a pathway to success, to improvement here, and I think we need to start taking a walk down that path.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes, thank you. You both said it well. I think the one thing that we need to keep in mind is being fiscally responsible, which we have been for the past many years here in San Luis Obispo County, includes taking advantage of opportunities like this one to utilize state funding to achieve an end. And I appreciate what Supervisor Gibson said, that we need to look at this new jail facility not as an end, but as an opportunity for a new beginning. And providing these services to people in jail will do that. And as I said, I'm fully supportive. And with that, I'll move staff's recommendation to begin the process of negotiations with the state to develop the contracts needed to build the new women's jail.
Second.
Okay. Moved by Supervisor Patterson, seconded by Supervisor Gibson. With that, we'll have a voice vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Against? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you for all the time that you've spent with us today and the time you spent bringing this to us today. It's much appreciated. We have one more item. How long is it going to take, Mr. Grant? Do we know? We don't want to exhaust everybody, but
I think we can do a staff presentation in 10 minutes.
Oh.
And then questions, another probably 5 or
great.
10 minutes.
And we see Ms. Brown getting ready to.
Yeah.
Okay. As we letting many people in uniform and such file out.
That just occurred to me.
We're going to go to our last item before closed session, which is a review of the redistricting process. And Ms. Brown from our administrative office is going to lead the report once she is fully functional with PowerPoint and all of that. So you'll let me know. Okay, Ms. Brown?
We need to pull that up. Okay, good afternoon. It's Leslie Brown from the administrative office, and I'm here to give a presentation on basically an overview of the redistricting mandate and process and timeline. And this is really an opportunity to educate the public about what's required, as well as to inform your board about what plans we have or are recommending. I'll talk about why we must do redistricting, what the process entails, the proposed timeline that we have to meet this mandate, and then at the conclusion, as I mentioned, we do have some staff recommendations for your board to discuss and provide any direction as necessary. So with that, why do we redraw the supervisorial district lines? The California Elections Code, the sections are cited here, requires that the board adopt an ordinance amending the district boundaries following the completion of the decennial census. And as you know, that was completed in 2010. And so the new district boundaries need to be in effect by November 1st of the year following the census. So that would be November 1st, 2011 in this case. And as we all know, each time the census is taken, there's inevitably population growth and population shifts among districts. And so this is an opportunity to take a look at that data, redraw the boundaries so that the population of the districts is as equal as possible, bringing us back into compliance with the one person, one vote mandate. There we go. The legal requirements that must be met, as I mentioned, we need to meet the November 1st deadline to have those new boundaries in effect. Excuse me. If this is not accomplished by your board, then there's a supervisorial redistricting commission that is responsible for this, and this is comprised of the district attorney, who would be the chair, the county assessor, and the county elections official, and they must adopt a plan by December 31st, which would be December 31st of this year. Also, as I mentioned, districts need to be as nearly equal in population as possible. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act must be complied with as we redraw these boundaries. And what that's really designed to ensure that the redistricting plan is not discriminatory against racial or language minorities, either in purpose or effect, even if unintended. So even if we do our best, that is an opportunity where there have been suits in the past. Not here, but. So such discrimination can occur if you have minority voters that are concentrated in a district to such a great number that it far exceeds the amount that is needed to elect the representative of their choice. Or alternatively, if there's a geographically concentrated population of minority voters that split between two districts, and so that they are unlikely able to elect the representative of their choice. So we will be careful to watch for that as we move forward. And finally, state law requires that there's a minimum of two public hearings be held by your board, at least one to consider either one or more redistricting proposals prior to adoption, and then a second public hearing to adopt the ordinance. And you'll see in the timeline that I've laid out that we've got that scheduled. So what does the redistricting process involve? Well, the first step really is to have this discussion today and for your board to decide what process or which approach it will take. You'll notice in the staff report that staff is recommending that you direct us to form an internal cross-functional team. This is the approach that we used in 2001. It was well received, and we were able to accomplish the project with minimal cost. This team would be responsible for implementing a public involvement plan that would make sure that the public has ample opportunity to provide input as we go, input before we develop our draft proposals, input or feedback once we present those proposals to them, and then opportunities to come to your board and speak in at least three different meetings. As an alternative, your board can choose to appoint an advisory committee of citizens, residents of the county, that would conduct the analysis and prepare recommended changes of the district boundaries. That needs to be done no later than August 1st of 2001. Once we get the census data, which we expect to have available to us by April 1st, this data comes in census blocks. That's the smallest unit, and so that could be, you know, a few blocks. The size varies, but it's determined by the Census Bureau. Those census blocks they must be kept whole when we move them from one district to another as we're playing with the population numbers to try and get the districts back into equal population balance. You can't draw a district line between those two blocks. I just wanted to clarify that for people up front. Once we get the district or the census data, we'll overlay that population on the existing boundaries, and that'll show us what the current population is for each district and where the imbalances are. So we'll be sharing that information. The Geographic Information System, commonly known as GIS, team in the Planning and Building Department will be doing the lion's share of the work on this. They have special redistricting software they're testing right now to make sure that it'll work. I know there's other software out there that we can purchase if need be, but this was free, so we're going to try this first. The GIS team will be preparing various options, you know, moving the census blocks from location to location or drawing the lines from, you know, with the census blocks to try and achieve balance. And there's probably three or four different ways that we could do that. So we're going to try and produce some options for you to consider. Other members of the cross-functional team, which would include the admin office, the county council, county clerk, recorder, and public works, will partner with the GIS team when we work through this analysis and draw these alternatives. Again, the goal is going to be equal population as near as possible. And there are other factors that your board can direct us to consider as provided for in the California Elections Code, and I have those listed here. Topography and geography, simply meaning that we would use natural barriers such as mountain ranges or rivers or large bodies of water when drawing the boundaries. Also maintaining cohesiveness, contiguity, and compactness of territory. By contiguity, we basically mean that all parts of the district are connected together. They're not going to be separate pieces. Compactness of territory doesn't necessarily mean a certain geometric shape of the district, but it refers more to the ability of citizens within that district to effectively relate with the representatives and they have shared interests. So this really gets to the community of interest. Included in that would be honoring existing political subdivisions like cities, community service districts, trying to keep those together in a district. And then by community of interest, this really refers to the intangibles that bring people together, such as shared economic interest or living standards or employment. It does not include a relationship to a particular political party or a incumbent or a political candidate. So that's important to clarify. Once we have the draft proposals, as I mentioned, we plan to present these to the public, and we would do that in two ways, at least two ways. We plan to launch a website that we can actually post these alternatives and all other redistricting-related information to keep the public informed. We also plan to host some workshops in various parts of the county. Last year we had four. We'll probably do something very similar again. And we will go out on the road and ask the public for their feedback on these options. And once we've gathered all that, we will summarize all that feedback for you, and we will refine what we had presented to the public and come back to your board in mid-July for further discussion and direction.
And just to clarify, we're looking at, I think, at least four public meetings moving out, one North County, South County, certainly San Luis Central, and then on the coast as well. So that's in addition to a couple of public hearings we'll have here in the chambers. So we want to get the word out, and we want to get public input as we move forward on this project.
Right. Okay. And then, as I mentioned, what we have scheduled two public hearings. The first would be to consider those final draft options, if you will. And these would be held in September. The first hearing would be optimally that your board would select one of these redistricting plans, and then the second public hearing would be to adopt an ordinance amending the district boundaries. And that ordinance, or the new boundaries, would actually go into effect 30 days from that date. So I won't repeat a lot of the steps that I just went through, but the next couple slides lay out the timeline. And let's see. The one thing that is on here that I didn't mention is that last time we did offer to make presentations to city councils, and we did make a few of those. A few took us up on that offer. It's another opportunity for the public to come in and to provide feedback. And so it'll take us about 5 or 6 weeks to prepare the redistricting proposals, and we plan to have those workshops in June. The dates, times, locations have not yet been finalized, but it'll probably be very similar to what we had done last time. So July 19th is when we would come to your board with our draft proposals that reflect the public input, and based on any direction you give us, in that meeting we would go back and refine those. Or if they're perfect, you can let us know that. And the first public hearing is scheduled for September 13th, where the board would look at the final redistricting scenarios and select a plan. Depending on how that meeting goes in July, if your board actually favors a scenario and there's no more rework that needs to be done, we probably could move this schedule up a bit. But for right now, this is building in enough time to refine as we need. The final public hearing would be on September 27th. That's when the ordinance would be adopted, and the new boundaries would go into effect on October 27th. So, as I mentioned, there are a few things that we are requesting board direction on. Staff is recommending that you direct us to form the internal cross-functional team and to conduct this analysis in-house, but with a robust public involvement plan, that we apply to the extent possible the criteria in adjusting the boundaries that I had gone through previously. I won't repeat the public involvement strategy unless you have some questions on that, because we're trying to move. And the final thing is the question of the state population and whether or not that should be included or not. And in 2001, we excluded that population. That's commonly known as prison gerrymandering? Or I'm trying to remember the exact term, but... we had written in the staff report of the 1991 State Attorney General's opinion that basically including prison population really it results in an imbalance because prisoners don't vote. And so the non-prison population in the district for which they're counted is given a lot more voting power than the other districts. So to wrap up, I have a simple slide that shows the current district boundaries, just for people's interest. And that concludes my presentation if you have any questions or comments.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. We do have a few questions, I believe. Supervisor Patterson?
Yes. Thank you, Chairman Hill. I might say in 30 of the last 40 years that I've been in San Luis Obispo County, the city of Atascadero, and it wasn't a city all of those years, but it had been compartmentalized, and it was just in the 2000 or 2001 redistricting that the city finally was included in one district. So I was pleased to see that. But I'm pleased to see the robust community outreach and the potential for people to be involved, two hearings here at the Board of Supervisors, four regional workshops. And Ms. Brown, you mentioned that in the past you had given presentations to city councils. Is that by invitation? In other words, if city councils wanted to have staff come and make a presentation to them, are you considering doing that, or would you do that?
I might take a shot at that. What we're thinking right now is with the four outreach sessions that some of those may be at the cities or all of them may be at the cities. We'll check in with the cities and see what they want to do, but typically get maybe a better cross-section of folks coming to the city council meeting than you would if you held just a separate redistricting meeting. The last time both Leslie and I were involved 10 years ago on this, and there were some of those occasions when we went out to seek public input that there were very few people there.
I see.
I'm thinking now that maybe if we had it as part of a city council meeting, we might generate a little bit more audience.
How long do those presentations generally take?
Well, again, our presentation would take somewhere between probably 15 and 20 minutes, and then there's typically quite a few questions at the end of that.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Hill. My question regards the usage of the advisory committee versus using internal staff. What's the downfall or one versus the other? I know Ms. Daniels referred to earlier about the county staff size being cut down and everybody's working to their max. Would this be a better thing to look at now that we're down on staff to take some of the advisories, take some volunteers to help and to move this process along?
Again, I'll take a crack at that. We discussed that. Obviously, there's pros and cons of both. We do think we have enough staff support to be able to work this. We are, again, familiar. Leslie and I, again, have been through this once, so we are familiar with the process along with our planning group. They have John Kelly has drawn the maps 10 years ago. So we have a very experienced team, I think, that knows some of the ropes and some of the pitfalls that we might be involved in, and we think we can do a good job for you. It's always up to the discretion of the board, though, where they want to go. If they want to have a separate community advisory group, they certainly can do that, and it's up to the board to make that call.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, I'm going to open it up to the public, and I have one request to speak, and we'll close it to the public after that. Gwen Taylor, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Gwen Taylor, and I'm a resident of Los Osos. Redistricting is a very serious situation. Having been involved in the past, I can attest to that. County officials are required to divide the political district's boundaries following the census, and there are apparently no strict procedural for the process. For the most transparency of the process of redistricting, the public must be a part of the process. If the board were to select four public members, which you can do through all of your electronic equipment, five elected persons, such as mayor, CSD members, and or councils, through a blind selection being done by county clerk. Comprising of nine members, the potential for political influence would be lessened. We've seen that in the past. I don't want to see it again. And gerrymandering was one of the biggest problems that was held a big question in the past. The past can and often does repeat itself. Just because it didn't happen last time does not mean that it cannot happen again. This is a very serious problem in districts that could be very, very much, shall we call it, impacted. I'm looking right now at the supervisorial districts, and I am seeing that District 3 is extremely small at this present time, according to what has been in the past. I would venture to say that the census will indicate that that area, that district, has expanded, has enlarged, and perhaps District 5 has reduced. Therefore, it is going to be very important that those districts be completely reviewed, just as the others must be reviewed, but the public has to have a say in it. And the way that is being proposed for in-house, as it's been called, redistricting plan to be established, it is not a transparent system, and I think the board should look at an alternative by using the public to get in on this at the very beginning, and it will not be as expensive as it might be with the $13,000 that has been projected in the report from staff. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. And finally, Mr. Wynn, Michael Wynn.
Good morning, gentlemen. I am Mike Wynn from Napomo. I did participate in this process 10 years ago. It was done. I remember it well. And although I agree with Ms. Taylor that public input is important, I really think it's simpler to do what your staff has recommended. And I say it for this reason. Much of what is done really isn't things you discuss. It's software-driven. You're taking the census material. You're loading the databases with the new data in place of the old. And I remember well when you move those lines around, that the totals shift on the map, and you can see very easily that they're balanced or not. Much of this is simply more nuts and bolts than it might appear to. I do look forward to the two public hearings that you have scheduled. I think those will be very important. It wouldn't surprise me if Mr. Teixeira's area rebounds from the north slightly as a result of some of the work we did in the past. And, of course, there will be expansions in other areas as a result. But overall, I think you're on a good track, and I urge you to stick with it. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. I will close it to the public and bring it back to the board, and I'm in agreement with Mr. Wynn in the sense that it's pretty straightforward. This is not like congressional or even state legislature redistricting. We have a county. We have the census data. We have the computer programs. We have the state codes to guide us. We also have the responsibility, which we are elected to, and we have a process that will be involve the public at many junctures, so I feel myself comfortable with the recommendation that we have going forward. I think we have good guidelines, and I think whenever the redistricting comes up, the thought is immediately to the larger country or state redistricting, which is really an entirely different kind of process. Otherwise, we wouldn't have budgeted $13,000, but Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm also comfortable with staff's recommendation on this. We're fortunate to have an experienced staff, although I'm sure Ms. Brown was a young student intern at the point that it was done last time. I know Mr. Grant is well, never mind. I won't go too far down that path. I do believe it's simpler and less expensive to get it done, and in the end, the decision on these districts does rest with the board. I think staff has outlined an excellent public participation process, and to me, ironically, I think the advisory committee might actually work a bit against that in perhaps even implied or suggested deference to a relatively few number of people rather than the wide public participation that I'm sure we're going to get on that. And if you don't have any other requests to speak, I'd be happy to move staff recommendation on this.
I'll second.
Okay. Staff recommendation moved by Supervisor Gibson, seconded by Supervisor Patterson. If there's no further discussion, we'll take a voice vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Closed session. I have no requests to speak from the public on that. Mr. Jensen, how long are we going to be in closed session?
Approximately 20 minutes.
Okay, 20 minutes. That's a breeze. We'll be back in 20 minutes.
Or so.
Or so.